Okay, I'll just start this.
Say something.
Hello?
No, you're not muted.
Well, is there a
okay.
Yeah, it says mute.
That's Carol. Okay, this is
Carol from New York.
No, that's Carol. Carol lives with Michael Edmonds. I can hear in the background Mike's telling her to mute.
Yeah.
So we begin in True Finnegan's Wake style. We begin in the middle. So this is our second Monday night seminar, recorded on March 7th, 2011, and our special guest tonight is George Thompson. George Thompson met Marshall McLuhan probably through Harley Parker, unless George will correct me on that, and was involved with the McLuhan Center since the mid-60s and worked on the Dewline card game that McLuhan produced in 1968, and he worked on the design of the book Counterblast that came out in 1969. There's other things that George did in that period. Then he became Marshall's assistant, replacing Morris McLuhan in the early 70s, and was with McLuhan until he passed on. So, welcome, George. An honor to have you here. And I would begin. I think I'll, since Michael Evans, who's here, has interviewed you before. What's something, Michael, you forgot to ask George? Let's just begin with that, if you can think of something.
Yeah, I actually have a question, George. Just have to be sure I got a paper here because I was thinking about this. But it relates to Harley Parker, which I think is an important question. In 1965, February 1 and 8, Harley presented to the Monday night seminar at the Center for Culture and Technology, and he talked on a topic called From the Iconic to the Pictorial and Back. Okay, and I mean, we can maybe look at more of what he said later, but my question is, so he goes a lot into the whole business there of visual bias of the Renaissance, and he has a whole history of art that he brings to the Monday night seminars. My question really relates to, is Harley already being biased in 1965 by having talked with McLuhan, or is he bringing this himself to the table, so to speak, for McLuhan to learn?
I was thinking the latter. Marshall did not have too much knowledge of art specifically, and so he relied on Harley and myself for what knowledge he had about art, and of course that was enhanced by René Seurat. René Seurat was, I don't know where his home base is, but he painted the great mural that we had in our studio for years. In a three part.
Pied Pipers, all Pied Pipers.
Presentation.
Yeah, speak up, Michael. You have to speak a little louder. Your reception is not
hear
perfect.
Me? Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yes, a little louder. That's good.
The René Seurat painting that George is referring to is the Pied Pipers using the eye and the ear famous mural that's in the coach house.
Yeah, and it's on our website, mcluhanconference.blogspot.com. You see it. And it was called Pied Pipers All, I think. Wasn't that right, George?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I'll say this. In 1971, I was talking to Harley Parker, and he said he taught Marshall everything that Marshall knew about art. Harley Parker would agree with George.
I would think so, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a vague philosophy, but it's quite true.
So in a way, what you're saying, George, is that, I mean, to me it shows that the great affinity that both McLuhan and Harley would have for each other. They would be like-minded people.
That's right. There's such a thing as perception in everything we do and see and feel and hear. And In all art, there's an understanding of what is perception. When you look at a painting or a drawing or whatever piece of art you want to call it, and that's my feeling anyhow.
Percept
and I try to convey.
Concept.
Pardon?
Percept versus concept.
Yeah, that's right.
George, are you aware that McLuhan would study the, what he called the pagan art of the secret societies? And he said that the techniques that the Gnostics and the pagans developed in relation to the senses were invaluable for understanding art. They weren't valuable for salvation, that's what he'd be speaking as a Catholic, but they were valuable for understanding the role of perception and the stages of apprehension in art. Would you agree with that? Does that sound familiar to you?
It's not familiar to me, no, but I still stand with my point on perception.
Say that again, Lives.
I still believe that it's perception.
Right, but the controversy McLuhan had was that as a Catholic, he had to have an explanation of why he studied the secret societies. And I understand he actually had you go over to the Kelly Library and look up all the Freemasonic literature.
Well, he did that too, yes.
Why do you think he was doing that?
I have no idea. Curiosity, I suppose. He was very much interested in the Masonic order, but in a reverse or a negative viewpoint.
That's right, but he does say in his letters to Pound in the early 50s that you can look at that information to understand perception.
I guess so, yeah.
Okay, does someone...
So would you say then on that topic, when McLuhan is looking at the cubist or the symbolist painters, what would he be thinking?
I didn't get that.
When McLuhan starts talking about the cubist movement in art or the symbolist, what would he be thinking back to?
You're fading away.
You're gonna have to yell, Mike. Don't mind, just yell.
Okay. I was just basically saying when McLuhan because we know Parker would be talking about the cubist and about the symbolist. That would McLuhan be bringing that dimension in then of the past, the way far past?
Now do it better. You gotta yell, Mike.
I'm going pretty loud. Maybe I can get another.
Bob,
phone.
Maybe you can paraphrase the question.
I'm going to go to another phone. Okay.
Okay.
So I'll just leave it for a sec.
Okay. Marshall wrote about art, George. You know, since the 40s, usually, and he was aware of Picasso and the Dadaists and Duchamp, and some say that the Mechanical Bride was named after a work of art by Duchamp. You went to art school there in Toronto. Did you ever talk art with him, particular history of art of the early 20th century?
No, I never did. No, when I was in art school, Harley Parker was my color teacher, and I got into a terrible accident because of that, arguing with a friend in my car on the way home from a... and it was a terrible accident.
Well,
my friend finally died just a few years ago.
Your friend died?
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
And this,
or just last year.
Right, and you're saying this, but you're okay in the accident.
I was okay, yeah.
But you were arguing over color that Harley Parker had presented in his class?
Yeah.
Well, was Harley new? Was he avant-garde? Was he different from the teachers there?
I couldn't say because I'm also an unknown quantity. I don't know anything about anything except what I'm taught.
But didn't Harley teach you color theory? Can you hear me now, Bob?
Yeah, it's just a little better, but you're going to have to talk as loud as you can because George won't hear it.
All right. Didn't Harley teach you color theory? George?
To whom are you speaking?
It's Michael.
No, Michael is asking you, George, did Harley teach you color theory?
George,
Harley,
yeah, he's there.
I'm here. Oh. Harley taught me color theory and a lot of other things at art school. I accidentally bumped into him some years later when he was a chief designer of the ROM.
Royal Ontario Museum.
Yeah.
And
I had wasted the first 10 years of my life drafting.
Wasted the first 10
finally
years.
Finally, I quit one day, one afternoon. Friday, I went into the boss and said, I quit. I don't like this anymore. And I went down to the museum. I said, Harley, do you need any help? And he said, I sure do. My assistant has just left, and I'm in a terrible mess. I have all these problems. Perhaps you can help me out.
Well, you walked from your job to Harley same day.
Yeah.
Pretty good synchronicity. So what is
year
this?
What year was that, George?
Yeah. Is this before he met Marshall?
About the same time.
Okay. And is Sputnik...
Do
you remember if Sputnik was up? Who was the president? Who was Diefenbaker prime minister at that time?
Who was before Diefenbaker?
I don't know. He was in there a long time. It wasn't Pearson. I'm just trying to relate it to something in the social life that you could connect the time. I don't know if you can remember dates. Is it the 50s, do you think, George?
Pardon?
Do you think it's in the 50s you went to Harley?
Oh, yes, early 50s.
Okay, so you were born in 1917, right?
That's right.
Okay, so you're 21. That'd be 1938. Is that when you start working, or are you in school longer?
No, George was in World War II.
Oh, okay.
He came back and went on a veterans program to go to school, and he chose to go to art school.
So that'd be the late 40s.
Yeah.
So then you graduate maybe by 1950 after 3 years in school. So that means you would work 10 years till 1960.
No, it doesn't work out like that. In 1960, I was still in art school.
Wow, you went back to school late.
Pardon?
Where did you go to art school? In Toronto?
Yeah, it's the Ontario College of Arts.
It was 19... Good night. I'm 94. Numbers screw me up.
Okay, well, we know you met...
It was the famous OCA, Ontario College of Arts.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I think that you would have been out of there by 1960 because you didn't hang around doing nothing for 5 years before you went to school, or did you? Did you go to school right after World War II?
No.
Oh, okay. So it was a few years.
I was a surveyor.
Okay.
Ontario Landscape Surveyor.
How long was that?
For a couple of years. It comes to my mind now when we talk about it. I started art school in 1946, I guess.
That's when you went to art school?
Yeah.
Okay, so you do that for 3 years approximately, right?
4 years.
So there's 1950. And then you get a job right away drafting?
Pretty well, yeah.
Okay, so about 1960, is when you walk into the museum and see Harley.
No, you got it all screwed up. After art school.
Yeah, that's 1950-51.
1951, you're right.
Okay, so you worked there about 10 years, so that's 1961, drafting, right?
That's right.
So 61, 62, you meet Harley, and I understand, according to Marchand's biography, it seems to be the late 50s, early 60s that Harley walks in, no, McLuhan walks into Harley's show in Windsor
London.
Or someplace.
London, Ontario.
Yeah.
London, Ontario.
Yeah.
And then that's when he found McLuhan's mind in response to the Harley's paintings. He was interested
that's
in
right.
that. Yeah. So then
that's
that,
right.
And then around.
Yeah, you got that all straight.
Beg your pardon?
That's okay.
Yeah, yeah. So now.
I'll buy that. Yeah.
So when you start working with Harley, does he tell you about McLuhan pretty quickly, or is after a couple of years there?
No, it was a little bit later. And he told me once how he met Marshall. Harley was having an art show in London at Fanshawe College.
Yeah.
And he wasn't selling very much. And he was a bit disappointed. And there's this tall, thin man kept looking at his paintings and studying them, and then going back a few feet and look at them again, and puzzled. And Harley finally gave up. He says, "Hello, I don't know who you are, sir, but I'm Harley Parker, the painter." And he says, "Oh, hi, I'm Marshall McLuhan. I teach English." And that was the first time they'd ever met.
So why?
And,
okay, go ahead.
Oh, and after that, they became pretty good friends. And Harley was interested in what Marshall was doing, or studying, or lecturing in the coach house.
Well, not the coach house. That hadn't happened yet. This would be that home. I mean, the St. Joseph Street.
No.
Well, did it have the name Center for Culture and Technology yet?
At that time that I was there, yes.
Okay. Well, St. Joseph's had that from 63 to 68. But see, you're already involved in McLuhan before the coach house becomes available after Fordham. So it has to be the previous place.
Well, I remember the previous place, and that was just an office.
Yeah, that was with Mark Stewart.
Yeah.
Okay, so he would have meetings in there?
Occasionally.
So what happened the first time you went with Harley to one of these meetings that you recall?
Nothing, except Marshall would say, "We need some wine." Wine? Yes, we need some wine. George, we're all on a first name basis.
Right.
Would you mind going and getting some wine? What kind do you want? What was the wine, the cheapest wine you can buy? So I will come back with a gallon of this crap. And we would serve that to all the students and anybody who wanted to come in.
Good. That's the beginning of the Monday night seminars.
That's right.
Wine distill. Wine dispensary.
Especially the time that I tripped as I coming in the door and spilled the bottle and it smashed on the door. And I had to go and get some more.
So why did you...
Again, the damn stuff gave me a headache, so I never drank it.
Why were you chosen to set
the... You still have that headache, don't you, George?
Pardon?
You still have that headache, don't you?
I do not have the headache anymore. Well, I was pretty close to it the other night.
So why, since you hardly knew Marshall, why did he ask you to go get the wine?
I have no idea. I was with Harry.
Okay, so in the seminar,
I have a slightly different question I wanted to ask about your work with Harley at the ROM. Because McLuhan became involved with it, the famous exhibit with the mask, which was the groundbreaking for museum exhibitions. You were involved with that, right?
That's right.
Do you have any stories about that? Because I heard that kind of ruined Harley's reputation at the museum, and maybe McLuhan's too.
I didn't, and that's the first I ever heard of any stuff like that. No, that did not hurt Harley. That was his crowning achievement. And we had the Premier of Ontario and other dignitaries all the way down the line to the mayor.
Was McLuhan
and
they
that? All came. They all came to the opening. And Peter Swan, a horrible little man who was the director of the museum at the time, he attended and took all the glory and all the applause for our great opening of our new gallery. And it went off quite well, actually.
That's good.
Hey, Michael, actually... Michael, what is this? What is this? The masks? What does the mask refer to?
Oh, they actually were, I guess, African masks, weren't they, George? Or were they Aboriginal masks from B.C.? I've forgotten.
Oh, they were all Aboriginal.
Aboriginal
masks. Aboriginal.
And Harvey set them up on pedestals and put weird spotlights on them.
Oh, that was another exhibition we had. At the museum,
Another one. So the multimedia, the extra lighting was not in the first one with the dignitaries.
No.
Right.
It had nothing to do with our gallery.
So this was revolutionary to show Aboriginal masks. It had never been done before.
I wouldn't know that.
I think the point of that is they had shown them, but they put them in cases, you know, like behind glass. And you walk
oh,
it
could
it.
Be.
But Harley created a basically a theatrical setting with the dramatic lighting and in different using different levels of the room.
Well, he certainly did that.
Yeah.
It was quite a spectacle if you'd ever seen it.
So what was it that brought Harley's downfall at the ROM? Why did they fire him?
Do it again, Mike.
George, what was Harley's downfall where they ultimately fired him from the ROM?
Well, Harley never had a downfall.
He didn't?
He was fired by Peter Swan.
The horrible little man.
Yeah. And the horrible little man. And we were all part of the package. And he fired a whole lot of us.
Well, how many exhibits did you and Harley put on before the firing?
Well, we used to have, we tried to have one major exhibit a year. One was a glass. That was a fantastic exhibition. And another, we did various, and the mask was another
Right. Now, do you recall McLuhan being at these?
McLuhan?
Yeah. What do you recall him attending these exhibits with you and Harley?
No, I don't.
Do you recall him being an advisor in any form to Harley?
No.
So
no,
does it say
Marchand? No, we don't did all this on our own.
Right. So does it say Marchand's book or Terence Gordon's book, Michael, that Marshall was involved with Harley and these
I
things?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So from George's perspective, not true.
Yeah. But the relevance of this is the firing business, George. You can help me on this. But didn't this give room for Harley to become a research associate at the center and ultimately go to Fordham with McLuhan? And you too, for that matter?
If you want to trace the events, I couldn't help you there because I was in the middle of it and I don't know what happened.
Well, George, I can remind you some of it. You told me that you were out in Calgary, the prairie somewheres. Marshall had gone to New York and you get a call from Harley to come on down to New York. Do you recall that?
I said, yes, that's true. Yes, I was in Saskatoon.
And
I got this. I was in Saskatoon, and I got a strange call in the middle of the night. And nobody knew I was there. And I picked up the phone, and Harley says, George. I said, Harley? He says, yes, it's me. Where are you? I'm in New York, and we need you here. Get down here as fast as you can. packed my bag and I quit my job there and on my way to New York. That's how I got to New York.
Well, why were you in Saskatoon?
I had to eat. Somebody offered me a job for $500 a month.
In design?
Well, hardly. Looking after a store is what I was doing.
Right. The thing is, this is 1967. McLuhan, that's his big year. The NBC does a documentary or a show around his Medium is the Massage book, and the album comes out. And yet, and Harley is somehow connected to Marshall here. Did you know when you were in Saskatoon that all this hoopla about McLuhan was happening?
I knew that that Marshall was in Fordham, but I didn't know that
he was becoming a media celebrity. You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that.
So when you get to New York, is that made apparent to you?
What?
When you get to Fordham, is it made apparent that Marshall's a celebrity, or it's still not an issue you notice?
No, he was all about the same. He was quite noteworthy. We met Woody Allen and people like that. Woody Allen is a, you might say he's an idiot, but I wouldn't say that.
So Woody Allen and them came out to Fordham to see Marshall, or you saw them in dinners in the village?
No, we met him at a studio, at his studio.
Right.
Wherever that was. I've forgotten where it was exactly.
Do you recall how he interacted with Marshall? Were they both talking? Was one listening to the other? How did that happen, if you recall?
No, Woody Allen stared at Marshall in his usual noncommittal way. And they ran along the weather or whatever.
Are you saying that Woody was noncommittal?
He was what?
You're saying Woody was noncommittal.
Yeah. He's a blank. And my Marshall just finally gave up and walked away.
Gave up and walked away.
He had nothing to say to nobody. Woody Allen being the nobody.
Yeah. Okay,
that
so
kind of relates to the later on for the Annie Hall when McLuhan had to rewrite all of Woody's dialogue.
Yes, the famous lie.
Corinne and Mady Molinaro told me that McLuhan couldn't say Woody's dialogue, so he came back and had to rewrite it. That he was all just, you know, like flummoxed about it. And Mady and Corinne told him, well, just stick to it. So what's in Annie Hall was not written by Woody Allen. It was written by McLuhan.
Yeah, and he wanted to just talk about himself. He wanted to point out and use the word fallacy. And that's where he says, to the professor, the other professor, you think my whole fallacy is wrong.
Yeah.
He wanted
to
say that.
Yes.
So
he did. He did.
Do you recall Marshall talking about that line with you? The effects of it? What happened?
No, not. It was just an event that meant nothing to Marshall.
So these, what you're saying is this stuff all just rolled off Marshall. He always moved on to the next event.
That's right.
I want to go back and more into this sequence, but one question I was thinking of yesterday was, it's been 30 years since you last saw Marshall, over 30 years. What is the main feature of Marshall that sticks strong in your mind? Marshall wrote about why certain memories stayed prominent in one's mind as they grew older. What's an image or a memory that sticks out about McLuhan for you?
Well, of course, the first thing is his friendship. And Marshall was very approachable and a great friend of mine. And I loved him like my own father. Well, I never had much of a father. And his whole personality and his reliance on other people like myself to do the little nitty-gritty things that you have to do around the office.
Yeah.
Organizing and stuff like that. And there was one. At that time, we lost Margaret Stewart, our secretary, who had broken her hip.
Yeah.
And she was not coming back. So we hired Eleanor
Austin. Yeah. That was in 1978, in the summer.
Yeah, she was a terrible, terrible character. She was a devil in female clothing.
No, why? I've thought I met Eleanor, and that's when Carol and I met Margaret, because Carolyn did some medical stuff, advice to Margaret in that May 1978 accident. And so we heard all about the trials and problems that Eleanor created. I actually talked about it last week in the first seminar. What, do you think that she was sent in by Father Kelly, or it was just her own peek at Marshall?
I don't think it was anything to do with Father Kelly. Father Kelly was a very intelligent man, but he certainly wanted to get rid of this load on his payroll. And so when the opportunity came to send Eleanor over to our little coach house, he jumped at the chance and he mentioned it to Marshall, and so Eleanor came over and started working at our place.
Do you think she had that attitude the first day, or after a while she didn't understand Marshall? Maybe Marshall was too impersonal and she felt ignored and then started to be messy. Could that have been what happened?
I don't know idea what she was feeling, but all I know is that she was a very nasty person, and she was very destructive for whatever reason, and she went through our office and ripped open the files and destroyed a lot of valuable correspondence that Marshall had.
I know. When I dropped in the office, you would see sandwiches, you know, lunch garbage in the filing cabinets.
And cheese.
And
cursed cheese.
Cheese, yes, cheese. But that's way at the end. Let's go back. So you remember his friendship. He's willing to allow people to join in, but they usually would help around. It's like he had a sense of an ongoing operation that he required and was open to who could help him. Is that what you mean, his amiability?
Oh, he didn't have his inability, no.
I said amiability, friendliness. He was open to volunteers.
Yes, that's right.
And you found that unusual among people his age?
Pardon?
You found that unusual among people his age, his generation?
As a matter of fact, I don't think I knew anybody his age.
Oh, okay. Now, we've talked about his Catholicism, and you told me once that you put Marshall up against 1,000 Catholics. He's not like any of them. Well, how did you understand what Marshall was doing with his Catholic faith?
What? Well, he was searching. Marshall, to his great credit, searching for the truth. But when he discovered the truth, it wasn't the truth, it was a lie. It was a lie. To me, anyhow.
Yeah, the truth he found.
His revelation was abhorrent to me. And he looked me straight in the eye and said to me one day, "George, you should become a Catholic." And I said, "Why?" "I don't want to become a Catholic. But it's the only true way of doing things, of getting a proper perspective." I said, "I don't think so." And I never did. And past events,
when you told him you didn't want to.
Hold it, Michael. Mike, hold it. Yep. George is saying recent events have proven. George says, prove George incorrect. George is correct about the Catholic Church and the priests and the pederasty and all that.
Right.
Yes, there's one little book that's very recent called The Medium and the Light.
Yes.
And there's a pieces in here which is rather interesting.
Yeah, that's the interviews by that Father Jacek and Eric Marshall's son organized some of Marshall's writings and essays on his faith or on Catholicism, mixed in with interviews by this father of the church. So what's interesting about that? I assume you read it all?
What was that again?
I assume you read all of the Medium and the Light book, that blue book.
I can't hear you.
Oh. I assume you read all of the book, The Medium and the Light.
You're fading away.
Hmm.
I can't hear you.
Well, can you hear me, Michael?
Hey, George, can you hear me? I can hear you good, Bob. George, can you hear me? George?
Okay, I'm going to call him back in a minute, but let him hang up.
Right. Hello?
Oh, okay. Can you hear us, George?
I can hear you faintly.
Okay. Michael, you speak.
The contact is slipping.
I was just wondering, George, when you told Marshall that you didn't want to be a Catholic, what was his reaction?
There wasn't any. Oh.
So you think maybe his asking you that was just a probe?
No. He was quite genuine.
He was
and
genuine.
This is quoting Marshall, and I quote from one of his letters. "My task as a teacher will be to shake others from their complacency how is it possible to conflate the products of English life, etc., literature, etc., without criticizing our own sterility? And that was key to Marshall's teachings and his philosophy. He could not stand stupidity.
And he had a lot of that around him, Matt, didn't he, at St. Mike's?
He sure did. And
I had a question about Father Kelly.
Too. Pardon?
I wanted to mention something about Father Kelly, but it's kind of towards the end. I don't know, Bob, you want to keep in the sequence?
No, it's all right. You can bring it up. I just wanted to say this. Michael,
yeah.
I don't know if George can hear me, but you can hear me. Did you notice that George said that when George said to Marshall, I'm not interested, Marshall went, oh.
I did notice that, yeah.
Okay.
Or
some
of
them didn't
remark like that.
Yeah.
But the point of Marshall's life and his philosophy, as far as I understand it, was as I just quoted you.
And you don't see that as a Catholic approach to life, the way you understand Catholics?
Reading further in these letters, I would say you're right. Marshall's idea of truth is found in the Bible, I suppose, and his adherence to the popish sayings, and which I would disagree with. So we were not on the same page at all. But Marshall pursued his studies through Chesterton and other great writers like that.
Yeah, now we found a clip, an interview by Nina Sutton in the mid-70s, where Marshall said he did not enter the church with any ideas in mind. He was studying the effects, he said, of the church, and they told him that if you pray, that you will be answered. So he studied that. He tried praying. And after a while, didn't happen right away, he said he got the answer. But what's odd, the answer was an interaction with a graduate student in Wisconsin. That's what he says on the recording. So this would be 1936, 37. And he says, the student asked him, why aren't you, after Marshall was talking about whatever, he says, why aren't you a Catholic? And Marshall said, had no answer for that person.
So he turned around and became a Catholic.
That's right, because he didn't have an answer. Now, is that the sign? Because he said he got a sign. Is that the sign? Someone say, why aren't you a Catholic?
I guess it's true. I suppose that's true.
Yeah, it's not some dramatic whale jumping in the Bay of Maui or something, or some other dramatic experience. It was a simple question by a student. It was a blinding light.
That's right. So Marshall continued studying Catholicism for the rest of his life.
That's right, studying the effects of it.
Yeah, or whatever. I don't know what he got out of it, but I guess he'll know now.
What were you going to say, Michael?
I was going to say nobody knows if that Cambridge oar of his fell on his head at that moment, do they?
What was that?
Remember Marshall had the big oar in the coach house?
Yeah.
His rowing oar?
Yes.
I'm just wondering if that fell on his head when he had his epiphany.
I don't know about that. I think it was an accident. And Marshall was very proud of the oar with which he had won. He had helped to win the famous race.
Yeah.
Win the what?
The famous race in Oxford between Oxford and the University in Cambridge. It's like the Grey Cup here.
Yes. So you see. You're saying that was a key thing, his rowing against Oxford?
No, I don't think so.
But what were you saying about the competition between Oxford and Cambridge?
Except that it was. It still is. And every year they have it.
Right, but in the academic world, the teachers at each institution, they have that competition too.
Yes, they did.
You could say that Cambridge is where the communists came out of in the 30s, so they're more the people's, the working class's representative university versus the high church of Oxford. So do you think McLuhan, what do you think he meant when he said he's not an optimist or pessimist, but an apocalyptic? Do you have any stories on that? He said he's not an optimist, and he's not a pessimist. He was an apocalyptic.
I guess that would be right.
Right.
And then nothing ever bothered my Marshall.
Good or bad, he took it all in his stride.
A kind of detachment?
Yeah. That's right.
His stroke, was he detached about that?
Well, when he suddenly had a stroke, he had nothing to say because he couldn't talk.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it true that, George, weren't you there for the last one that he was at the photocopy machine when he had that?
He was standing in front of my desk.
Right next to the copy machine. And what did he? What was? Didn't he have one word stuck in his mouth?
He said, "I've got it. I finally got it." That person upstairs to finally type out the last few pages of my essay on space.
Yeah, on visual space. And he's saying that he got what Elinor Ostin threw away.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And then he had a stroke.
At that particular moment, he went all strange. He's got distortion in his face, and his body started to twitch, and he fell down. And I put him in the front room and on the sofa, and we called in the doctors and took him to St. Mike's Hospital. And incidentally, I think Marshall was among the first to receive treatment from that new gimmick, the whatever you call it.
New chemic? New part of the hospital?
Yeah. Because just a few weeks, a week or so before that, the Queen of England, the real Queen, had come over to do her due duties by the installation of this brand new machine.
Hey, George.
Yeah.
Do you know what Elinor Ostin's reaction was? Because she was in the building, wasn't she?
She was in the building, but not just physically. I was yelling and screaming, "Get on the telephone," but she wouldn't. And she lost all control.
So
she had no idea what to do.
She wouldn't do it.
Pardon?
You asked her to call like 911 or something, and she wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Was she already on the phone talking to someone else for other reasons?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. So you yelled at her the phone, and she wouldn't do it. But Marshall, this is the famous visual space essay. I've seen that. I may even have a copy of it. That essay I saw that mailed out to John Cage and different people, Ted Carpenter. He had that 78, 79 is maybe when I saw it. That was the beginning of Laws of Media, Eric says later. He used that essay and built from that. He died solving a dilemma that Eleanor had caused. That's what you're saying. And not died, but he had the stroke. That Eleanor, the frustration of Eleanor is what he was dealing with when he had the stroke.
Well, that's my opinion.
Right.
That's my opinion, that she brought on the stroke.
Right. And so over that essay, I heard him many times talking to Mark Stewart when I was visiting Mark Stewart. He'd be on the phone begging Margaret to come back, even though Margaret was paralyzed, could not come back. But he was so desperate, he wanted her to come back. And that went on for 6 months to a year before his stroke.
It certainly did.
Yeah.
And my Margaret Stewart never did come back.
No, she couldn't. Her hip didn't heal that well. She never got healed. I used to visit her up in her cottage in the 80s, and I last spoke to her in the early 90s before I went to New York City, and she was still laid up, never was able to walk again.
And that's right.
Did you see her in that period?
Yes, I did. I used to go quite often to see her and her husband.
Jim. Yeah, let's talk about Margaret. You knew how valuable she was. Let's talk about Margaret, her role in the center.
She was a gift from God, if you believe in God, for Marshall. She was a secretary in his little office at the beginning of time. And I don't know when she started, but she was an extremely superb typist. Take shorthand or anything like that.
Yeah, from dictation.
Pardon?
Marshall would dictate most of his material to her.
That's right.
And she'd type it up. And, she started in 63, 64, right when the Center for Culture, when he got that role.
And the strange thing about Marshall and animals. He had a dog called Maggie. And we all loved Maggie. But on one occasion, I have a dog too, a black cocker spaniel. And I didn't know what to do with her, so I took her to work. And she would sit underneath my table. And suddenly she disappeared one day. Where did she go? She's gone out. She's going to get run over. So I'm in a panic. And I said, I wonder. So I sneaked up the stairs very silently. And there she was, underneath Marshall's table, wherever he was sitting. And he had his hand on her head. And she was looking so thoughtful, the little dog. And So I took it from that. He was dictating to Margaret Stewart at the same time. So he was drawing his energies from a little black cocker spaniel.
Right.
That's my opinion.
So did you see him, this dog Maggie that Marshall had, that was never at the office, the dog?
No. Well, yes, Maggie used to come to the office. I have pictures of Maggie in the office.
So when he would take his legendary walks around Witchwood Park with Corinne, I guess the dog would go with him.
I wouldn't know about that. I never walked around the park with Corinne, and I was always with Marshall. He would point out to me all the houses and the famous people who lived there, or famous or infamous.
Right.
Well-known political figures and all that. And it was rather interesting.
Did you ever see Tom Wolfe visit the coach house?
I never saw him at the coach house, no.
Did you ever see Andy Warhol at the coach house?
No.
What did you think of Ted Carpenter at Fordham? Because you would have seen him there.
What about him?
What stories do you have about him?
Well, all I know is he was an anthropologist, and he's a good friend of Marshall's, and they would correspond occasionally. Possibly Eleanor Austin had tossed out most of that correspondence.
Hmm.
So, I never saw any of it.
Right. Now people talk about this intellectual, that intellectual, Wyndham Lewis, James Joyce, Etienne Gilson had influences on Marshall. I've heard Gerald O'Grady and maybe Eric say nobody influenced Marshall. Would you agree with that?
No. Chesterton, for one, was one of McLuhan's great inspirations.
But that's in the 30s. He wrote an article in the 70s, I have it, where he says he's not that impressed with Chesterton anymore. He doesn't get the inspiration. Now, that's 40 years later. Did you ever hear him talk about Chesterton to you?
He never talked to me specifically about that, no. I wouldn't know about that.
Okay, so what do you think people today are not understanding about Marshall's message? What's something, you're aware of what goes on and the books have been written over the last 30 years. What do you think, from your experience, Marshall, they're not getting about Marshall and what he said?
Well, those who have studied his work would say, as I would, that Marshall's chief ambition in life, or his goal, you might say, would be to shake the complacency out of the students. And his greatest achievement would be in the success of his students. And this is the way he lived. And that would be his main doctrine, to get people to think. And specifically, but usually he would come in the morning. What's the joke for the day, George?
He would ask you for a joke.
Yeah, I had to have a joke every day in the morning. Sometimes I didn't. So I would quote the Globe and Mail had a little
I remember that
humorous saying. Anyhow, and and from there on, he would walk into the seminar room and be covered. It was all cluttered with magazines and articles and newspapers, and he. What do we talk about today?
He'd ask you? He would ask you that?
No, to the students.
Oh, okay.
And so he'd pick up a newspaper from the clutter. You see that headline? It's all wrong. You wait till tomorrow. It'll contradict this one. Never believe what you read in the paper. And he was absolutely right.
So that was his opening?
There was a distrust of public news. Do you hear me?
Yes, we heard that. Excellent. So that is what he was teaching kids, at least in the later years, a distrust of the media, of the content.
Yes. Well, what happened following these seminars and other meetings nobody would understand what Marshall was talking about. Because he could get carried away with five-syllable words and all that kind of stuff. And then the meanings of this. And so they would say, George, did you understand what Marshall was talking about? Yes, I did. Would you please explain it to me? So there would be a group of kids and myself, and we would go over to the what was the name of that hotel on the corner?
It began Carr Hall.
Pardon?
Carr, C-A-R-R.
Where's that hotel?
Oh no, Sutton Place. Sutton Place.
Pardon?
Sutton Place.
Sutton Place. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And we would sit there and drink coffee till 2 or 3 in the morning while I explained what Marshall was saying. And that's where I learned more about McLuhan.
From their responses.
Yeah, and questions. What did he mean? And anyhow, I was usually right, but occasionally I was quite wrong.
What did you say? I didn't get that. Who was?
George.
Who was wrong? You?
Me.
In retrospect.
Usually right, but sometimes wrong.
Oh, okay. In retrospect, when you evaluate what you did say to the kids, you were generally right, but sometimes wrong. That's what you can know now.
That's right.
Right.
Did it matter?
Well, go ahead, Mike.
Did it matter?
Did it matter? No,
well, yeah,
it didn't matter at all.
Weren't you just having a dialogue?
Marshall would straighten me out. And anyhow, that's the way we did things. Marshall was a great teacher.
He'd get people thinking, and then people wouldn't be able to continue to ask him questions, so they have to go to you.
That's right.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Marshall was one of the great orators of all time.
Yeah, I think that when you...
He had a great stage presentation.
Yeah, several actors I've met through the years, they'd never heard of McLuhan, but when they would hear a recording I had of him or some TV broadcast, they'd be stunned as actors at the power in his voice.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's go back to what happened. How did you get to do the Dewline cards? How did that happen? Did Eric create the Dewline cards?
I created the Dewline characters.
The cards.
I created the whole idea. We were sitting around in Witchwood Park one day, and no one knew anything. And there was a group of professors and other people that we knew, and there was silence for quite a while, and Marshall finally got fed up and says, "For God's sake, George, say something." "Why me?" I say. "I've got a small brain, and I'm trying to use it." And Marshall jumped 3 feet in the air and said, "That's the greatest bit of..." That's it. "Write that down. What did you say?" And that became his favorite quote. "I've got a small brain,
and I intend to use it."
Yeah. Later on, we're putting the cards together. My idea was we wanted to have a universal card game of some kind, because card games are fairly universal. And so we developed the program with the aneurysm on each one.
An aphorism, not an aneurysm. An aphorism.
That's right. Maybe I was right.
So this would be after Fordham. Come back to Witchwood. He's just moved into Witchwood Park. He's just moved into the coach house. That's after Fordham. This is when the Dewline was done. you're saying.
That's right. That's right.
It was not done in New York City.
No.
Even though the corporation that was doing the Dewline newsletter starts in July 68. He's back in Toronto after the year at Fordham. Do you remember the beginning of the newsletter idea itself?
No, I didn't. You'd have to ask Eric about that. Eric was the one who did the newsletter in New York.
Right. That's how I understand. But it's because you came up with that line about the small brain. That inspired Marshall to make cards, or you suggested cards to make more lines.
What was that again?
Okay. You came up with the idea of the cards because he was so enthusiastic with the small brain quote.
Yeah.
What do you think of that, Michael? No, go ahead, George. Go ahead, George.
Anyhow, we developed the idea of the cards and I changed the face of the face cards from the Jack, Queen, King, and Ace, and I did a little cartoon of each of those.
Yeah. So, do you have a? Go ahead. I'm interrupting.
And that was when the astronauts made their first landing, but they landed from parachutes, I guess, and they were in a capsule, and it whacked. It landed in the water, supposedly it floated, and there was a. The Navy SEALs, whatever you call them.
Yeah.
That they jumped in the water and took the astronauts safely out of the net.
That is the image on the deck of cards. Yeah, the parachute.
And my Marshall was fascinated with that whole idea.
Yeah. Well, George, he wrote in the 50s. In the 50s, he wrote in Explorations that government was now in the age of paratroopers, and he was talking about the CIA dropping in around the world, you know, organizing local dictatorships. He called that the age of paratroopers because the global village could be organized quickly with intercom by the Pentagon. So now you have the paratroopers landing in the ocean or landing back on the Earth. The paratrooper theme is part of his thinking.
That's right. It all adds up.
Yeah. The drop-out becomes drop-in.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, do you have anything to say to that, if you're still here?
I'm here. I had to miss part of that, so I didn't hear all the discussion. But yeah,
you can what?
I missed
the... Can you hear what we're saying?
Yeah, I heard it. I heard some of it. I went away to get the card. I was looking at the King of Spades before I got a small brain.
You have the card right there.
I got it in front of me. It's a monkey. And it's a King of Spades. I don't know what that means. There's always four suits in the deck. But it's a good drawing.
So the King of Spades is a monkey.
Yeah.
The King of Spades is a multi.
Yeah, you.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
well, you designed it. You designed it, but you can't remember it.
That's right. I designed the whole deck of cards.
Well, when you were talk a bit about when you were in New York City. That was you've told me it was a pretty interesting time because you'd meet a lot of people, went to the village, went to clubs with Harley Parker. Anything stand out from that period?
Our activities centered around Washington Square. That was a little area, and it was known as a drug hangout.
Yes.
But the buildings surrounding the square were great big mansions.
Yep.
And we would often have parties there.
Yeah, the people in that area would be the types interested in Marshall's work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you remember Jerome Agel or Quentin Fiore?
Yes, I remember them.
They did the album and the book, and Marshall didn't necessarily like the mediumism massage or the album. He said they weren't even books. What do you recall him saying, or stories about Agel and Quentin Fiore? What do you remember, anything about them?
I haven't got anything at all to say about them. I don't know anything about them other than their names.
Right. You think you met them, though?
I never met them.
So what went on at Fordham? You were in the design room. You weren't in the classrooms.
That's right.
And so what do you recall you and Harley doing there that year?
Well, I do know that Harley gave a few lectures, which were pretty good, along the McLuhan line. And that's about all I can remember.
You said
I'm sure that there's a record of it someplace.
Yeah, Tony Schwartz has a lot of those, and they're at the Smithsonian now.
Yeah.
I think it's the Smithsonian or the Library of Congress, can't remember, or the National Archives, something like that. But the
the principle of this whole discussion is that Marshall was a multi-purpose man who was obsessed with Catholicism. He was finding, because in Catholicism he would find the truth. And I don't know if he ever found it or not.
Well, he at the memorial to Marshall in early 1981 at Convocation Hall at the University of Toronto, I was there, and Father Kelly said that Marshall considered the Mass the greatest medium, the greatest art form. And the whole idea of media as things that eat us while we eat it and we're transformed, that can be a metaphor for the Mass. The action of the Catholic Mass is a metaphor for how all other technologies interact with humans.
I suppose that's quite true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Marshall would talk to me on occasion about the Mass.
Yeah. When you were at Fordham, when I talked to Jim Stewart about it, he remembered the warehouse where the Dew Line was kept, and he said it was run by a bunch of mafia guys. Did you ever experience that or see those guys in the warehouse?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
Did you know that at Fordham, the controversy over paying McLuhan, and Fordham lost the grant from the state because they were a Catholic university, so Fordham had to rely on their own resources and budget to pay McLuhan, that it bankrupted Fordham, and Edward Wakin told me 1968 to 98, 30 years later told me that Fordham never recovered from the debt they accumulated because they had to pay McLuhan. Did you ever hear anything about that?
I never heard that. That's the first I've heard of it.
Right.
I think it's a lot of hooey.
Really?
I don't believe a word of it.
Why would you say that? There was a controversy, and the state didn't support Fordham. They wouldn't support the Schweitzer chair.
That's quite... Maybe there is, or maybe there isn't. I don't know. But because it was a Catholic center.
Yes.
And... that's about all I know. I'm sure the church would never allow a financial catastrophe of any kind.
Hmm.
But that's my opinion.
Right. That was told to me by Ed Wakin, who did a couple of good interviews that are in the Medium and the Light. He was the main Catholic. I don't know if he was a priest but he was a teacher at Fordham. He's the one who did the interviews where Marshall talked about being an apocalyptic. Anyways, he personally told me that. Lance Strait introduced me to him in the spring of 1998 at Fordham. But anyways, the thing is, when you're, where do you start doing Counterblast? Is that in New York or back in Toronto?
I guess it began in Fordham.
Did you look at Wyndham Lewis's Counterblast or his Blast magazine?
Oh, yes, yes. We studied that.
Right.
We don't. I don't believe it. But whatever conclusions there were, I have no idea.
You don't believe what? Blast by Wyndham Lewis?
About the research. But the research went on at that time.
That you did with for Counterblast.
Pardon?
You did research for Counterblast by looking at Wyndham Lewis's Blast from 1914.
That's right.
Yeah, now you studied it. Then you just said you didn't believe it.
I didn't believe the research. what on earth is there to research?
Well, you said you did study Blast. Are you calling that research?
I suppose you can call whatever you want.
But you didn't
just a comparison.
Right. And what do you mean by saying you didn't believe it? It wasn't relevant?
It was really irrelevant.
Okay.
Yes, because Marshall was light years ahead of anything in Counterblast.
In Blast by Wyndham Lewis.
Blast.
Yeah.
Blast. Yeah.
I think what you're trying to say is that it wasn't that useful for doing Counterblast to look at Blast.
Yeah, Michael.
I don't say there's much difference because we absorbed that just as a partial, as a particular reference. That's all. I have a.
You guys were artists. You were going to make your own. You were going to make your own thing. Blast was just something that. Okay, you looked at it, and then you went ahead and made Counterblast.
That's right. That's where I got mixed up in my answer.
Right.
Because we took all of Counterblast and absorbed it into Counterblast.
And that was puny compared to what Counterblast itself had to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what... Why is your name not on there? Why is Harley Parker's name on there, on the book, Counterblast?
Well, do you have to ask Harley or Marshall about that?
Okay. You got no royalties.
I got no royalties.
Well, do you think that book sold well? What did you hear after?
I thought it was a pretty good seller. It wasn't on the New York top 10.
No.
Every week or anything like that. But I guess it was intellectually popular.
Okay, we got other people here. I assume I don't know who you are. You can ask George some questions about anything that you connect with McClune and George. Go ahead, whoever's there.
Hey, George, this is Chad.
Yes, Chad.
Did you ever get to meet Wyndham Lewis through Marshall?
Did I what?
Did you meet Wyndham Lewis?
Did I meet Wyndham Lewis?
Yes.
No, I never met Wyndham Lewis.
Wyndham Lewis died in 1957, Chad, in London, and... It was just after then that Harley would meet Marshall. But no, George wouldn't have had the opportunity to meet him.
Did McLuhan speak much of Lewis's influence on him to you?
About Wyndham Lewis?
Yeah.
Yes, we spoke at length about Wyndham Lewis.
Would he talk about Lewis, just a minute, Chad, would he talk about Wyndham Lewis in the class, if you overheard the classes? Would you ever hear him talk about Lewis to the students?
No.
not to the students.
No, not that I know.
Okay. Go ahead, Jed.
Did he talk much about his idea of visual space as a result of studying Lewis's paintings?
I don't know what Wendell Lewis was talking about when he talked about visual space, because Marshall jumped right over that one.
Marshall was not involved.
George, I think, means he was not involved with visual space, but Marshall did write about how Lewis played with visual space and put tactile values in his painting. But you don't recall Marshall talking about Lewis's paintings?
No, not really.
More about his ideas?
No.
So, not, George, what was the most memorable point about Lewis that McLuhan brought up to you?
The most memorable point about Lewis?
Yeah.
Well, I know Lewis was a rather strange character. He flitted around, and he used to cross the ocean quite often.
Yeah.
And he'd always end up in Toronto, and he hated Toronto.
This is what you remember Marshall saying about Lewis.
Yeah. And Lewis said it about himself. He absolutely hated Toronto.
Yes. He wrote a novel about it called Self-Condemned. And Marshall's in that novel as a character.
He is, eh?
Yeah.
I missed that one.
Yeah, if you get a chance, if you can still read, look up the novel Self-Condemned.
Okay.
And it came out in 1950.
I can still read. Okay. I'm still alert.
Okay, so look up the character. He's a professor. There's Rene Hart. No, I don't know what his name is in that book. Forget the name of the character. And is it Rene Harding?
I think so.
Yeah, it's Rene Harding. So Rene is Lewis coming to Toronto, and he meets a professor named, I think it's John McKenzie. And they have a lot of dialogues in the novel. That's McLuhan.
Who? John McKenzie?
John McKenzie, I think, is the character name. If anybody has a copy of Self-Condemned, they can look it up. Go to about page 300 or so is when McKenzie, I think, shows up.
Okay, I'll take a look at the book.
Yeah, because Don Thiel told me at the time that Marshall was quite proud to be in the novel because, you know, Thiel was around him in 54 when it came out and was delighted by it. And it would be about Marshall. The character of Marshall would come from when he had Wyndham Lewis in St. Louis. In St. Louis,
well, that's quite possible. Those are the early years of McLuhan.
Yeah, that's in 43, 40. He meets Lewis in 43, and he gets in Windsor, and he takes where Chad is from, and originally, right, Chad?
Yeah.
Yeah, McLuhan takes Lewis down to St. Louis, Missouri, whatever it is, and has him there for a year or two, trying to get him painting commissions. And they were going to start a magazine, but then Lewis got paranoid about McLuhan, as he always did with everybody, McLuhan said. And so then Lewis went back to London after the war because Lewis's wife missed London, was the apparent reason. And Lewis was a nobody when he went back, you know, like an outcast, an enemy, a wastrel. Yet his reputation was recovered in the next few years to the point BBC did a radio version of his trilogy, The Human Age, three books that he was working on in the late 40s. So his reputation got improved.
It was revived.
It was revived. And Marshall, I don't think Marshall wrote to him much during those years, but then when the novel came out, Marshall, we have correspondence between Marshall and Lewis. Marshall starts writing to Lewis again.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sends Hugh Kenner around. Did you ever encounter Don Thiel?
Don Thiel?
Yes.
Yes, I knew Don.
What did you see, what do you remember of him in his work with Marshall, or anything with Marshall?
Not much.
Not much. Well, he wasn't with Marshall in that period, 67, 68. He was in Montreal.
Not that I know of.
Right. Do you remember do you remember the controversy over Don Thiel's book on Marshall in 1971? Do you remember Marshall complaining about that?
Yes, there was some conflict about that.
Yeah, you remember that.
Yeah.
So what do you make of Harley Parker's career? Here's in 1968 in Fordham, there was a film titled Picnic in Space, made by some artists, filmmakers in New York City. Did you see any of that when you were at Fordham? Hear any talk about that? Harley and Marshall.
No, I didn't. But as far as Harley Parker's career, I knew Harley Parker as I knew the back of my own hand. As far as I'm concerned, Harley Parker was a great guy. He was a wonderful person. And he was much maligned.
Much maligned. And he was one of the few intellectuals who could hang out with McLuhan back then.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Harley Parker and Marshall McLuhan looked alike.
Yeah.
They had the same personality on a speaker's platform. It was terrible when Harley lost his voice through cancer.
Yeah.
And he said he would never use a mechanical thing to make himself speak. So he taught himself to speak.
Well,
and he never did use a mechanical device of any kind.
Well, do you remember Sheila Watson coming around?
Watson?
Yeah, Sheila Watson and Wilfred Watson.
What about them?
Do you remember them being at the coach house?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did.
Because Marshall, his correspondence and relationship with Sheila was pretty special. He could write about his literary interests in his new terms, his meaty terms, seemed to be only to her.
I suppose so. That's beyond my knowledge.
Well, did you hear the conflict between Wilfred Watson and Marshall in the late 60s at the coach house?
Pardon?
Did you hear of the conflict between Wilfred Watson and Marshall at the coach house in the late 60s after Fordham?
I did not hear.
Okay.
Not directly. I just heard the after effects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody else got questions?
But George, didn't you, you were aware of how they wouldn't talk to each other and Margaret Stewart had to kind of be the mediary between the two of them as they sat upstairs writing the book?
That's true.
Was at that time, right?
Yeah, that's right. I heard all that, and the Wilfred would ask a question. Mrs. Stewart, I have a question. So he'd ask the question. He said, "Would you mind transferring that to the other person in the room?" And the other person in the room, of course, would receive the same message from Mrs. Stewart, and so Marshall would then speak indirectly to Wilfred and Mrs. Stewart in reply to the question, and it went on like that.
So Margaret would repeat the words Marshall said back to Wilfred.
That's right. it was a panic
breakdown.
It was a total breakdown.
What did you say, Michael?
Total breakdown between the two of them.
Did you ever see Bucky Fuller at the center, coach house?
I never did, no.
Missed him.
I don't know anything about Bucky Fuller.
So, Chad, do you have any more questions?
I was just wondering if Marshall ever talked to George about his experience when he was at Assumption College in Windsor.
That'd be in the 40s.
Yeah.
When who was
Marshall. When Marshall was at the University, Assumption University, University of Windsor, at the end of the World War II, was the year or two he was there. Do you recall, Marshall, Tom, with that period?
No, I didn't. That was the end of the war.
Right.
And we didn't. The only thing I know about Marshall and the war is rather adventurous travel back and forth. You say at the beginning of 1940, I guess it was.
Yeah.
The Canadians were asked to be deported, or they were evacuated from England. But no wife and husband were allowed to on the same boat, and that was quite true. So. I guess Marshall came first, and then Corinne came second, his wife.
Yes.
And that was quite an adventurous period, and they survived it. Where many others did not, but he did.
Yeah, they had to take the route maybe up towards Iceland into the icebergs and avoid the Nazi submarines.
That's also, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, George, I was wondering, I thought you kind of remember these different things. What did McLuhan think about the Kirchhoff?
Derek de Kirchhoff.
Two words. Not much.
And how about the guy, what's his name, that was hanging around there and doing his PhD on the McLuhan, Tom Cooper?
Tom Cooper.
Yeah.
Tom Cooper was a brilliant young man, but he was totally self-concerned, and he twisted and turned everything he could. I remember him coming in with some photographs of the family. Of McLuhan's family from out west, from whence Tom had just returned on one of his trips. And later on, I got a phone call from the people and telling me a story about the photographs. We never got them back, you know. Well, I have them here. So I guess I sent them on, but I never heard any more about it. Tom never mentioned it. And Tom was not a nice person in a way.
But
I guess he's a professor now at some place.
What he did in 1976 he made a play about Marshall McLuhan and Harold Innes. I think it was No How versus No What versus Noah. And I attended the rehearsals. I didn't see the final product. But Tom was very keen on this play about the drama between Innes and McLuhan. Do you recall that play? Did you go to it?
I did not go to that play.
You heard of it, though.
I heard of it, yes.
Hello?
I heard a lot about that play.
Okay, here's Gerd Stern, I think. Is that Gerd Stern?
Yes, I tried before, but I couldn't get through, so now I got through.
Okay, very good. We're talking to George Thompson, who was at Fordham University in 68. Did you visited the Fordham group, right, Gerd?
Quite a few times. That's where I first met Paul, and of course I had known Marshall before that, and also the good father.
John Culkin.
Yep, Mom.
John
Culkin.
Yes.
Yeah, I had met John with Marshall before, and I had been up in Toronto, and of course Marshall and I knew each other from both Vancouver and Rochester, among other places.
I haven't put my... There's rain happening here. I'm just shutting the doors. Sorry for the noise. shutting the windows. So, Gerd, George is 94. Is this in March? Gerd's 82. You were part of the same scene in New York. So, Gerd, tell some stories about Fordham that what you remember, see if it sparks George's memories.
Well, you know, I wasn't part of the faculty, but I attended some of the sessions, and we also had some New York social contacts, including the story I told you several times, I think, about the doctor who diagnosed Marshall's headaches.
Yeah, tell us that.
Well, as I remember it, we were at a fairly large party in the city at somebody's fairly swank place, and Marshall got this frightening headache and went and rested in the bedroom, and after maybe half an hour came back out, and he and I were talking, and he said that it had subsided, and that was fairly typical when this gentleman came up to us and gave Marshall his card and said, "I'm Dr. So-and-so, and Professor McLuhan, would you come to my office tomorrow, because I think I understand what your headaches are about." And Marshall went, and sure enough, the guy diagnosed that there was a benign tumor, and it wasn't psychosomatic, as everyone had told Marshall, and he removed it, and the consensus was that now Marshall would be quite different. The only difference that I think anybody noticed was that he no longer got headaches, but his style remained his style, which was, you know, I don't like to use the word unique very often, but he did have a unique style of presentation, and he
controversial,
could,
maybe.
He
controversial.
I don't know. It was so controversial. He had the ability to skip from point to point, and you had to make the jumps with him. Because if you didn't make the jumps with him, you would get very confused.
That's right. That's where I came in. I had to explain all that.
I'm very, very impressed to have read some of the things that Bob sent me of yours, and it's a pleasure to be on the same airwaves with you.
Well, I'm very glad to be able to hear you. I'm 94, March of 27th. And there's a lot of people in this retirement home who don't have enough wit to tie their own shoe. you know, so...
But you're painting still, George. You're
yes,
still painting.
Yep.
George is the one who designed the book Counterblast.
I remember it well.
And you know the Dewline card deck. Did you ever see that?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we found out today George is the one who made that.
I'm not surprised. It sure wasn't Harley Parker.
Yeah. That's right. Wasn't Harley Parker.
Did you know Harley Parker, Gerd?
Yes, I knew Harley. The reason I mentioned him in terms of the cards because Parker was a big game maker, right? Although that was a different Parker.
Right.
Yeah, are you saying Harley Parker made games, or are you referring to another person altogether?
No, you know, isn't Monopoly a Parker game?
I don't know. Is that what it is, Mike?
I think so. Yeah.
Who knows?
But it wasn't made by Harley Parker.
Well, of course not.
Okay.
One Parker is not another Parker.
You're jumping. You're jumping from theme to theme, Gerd, like McLuhan.
Well, you know, sometimes you can't find a parking space.
So the
Picnic in the Park, we referred to that film just a few minutes ago.
No, Picnic in Space.
Picnic in Space, but we should have called it Picnic in Parker.
Yeah. Did you, because it features Marshall and Harley Parker, did you ever see that film, Garrett, Picnic in Space, made by a New York filmmaker?
I don't think so.
Okay, so back to, you were saying, George is a painter. George designed the cards. George said that the jumping from topic that would confuse the listeners to McLuhan, George was saying earlier with the students, he would go after the classes to Sutton Place and spend hours explaining McLuhan to the students.
Somebody must have gotten a big kick out of that.
I remember,
you know, Marshall talking like it at NYU on the same stand with the et cetera editor.
Neil Postman.
No.
No, the guy Korzybski, and then the guy after Korzybski, right?
Yeah, the guy from California.
Japanese guy.
Hayakawa.
Yes.
I knew Hayakawa. We used to go fishing together in San Francisco Bay, but it turned out that Marshall had delivered newspapers to his family in Canada when Hayakawa was a kid, which Hayakawa during that speech said he didn't believe that ever happened, so that was kind of a funny twist.
You mean you're saying that Marshall claimed that Hayakawa delivered papers to his home?
No, the other way around, that he, Marshall, delivered papers to the Hayakawa's house.
He was a newspaper boy.
Yeah. And so Hayakawa was in Winnipeg or Alberta and Edmonton, which place?
He was in Canada, all right. I'm not so familiar with Canada, but where was Marshall when he was a boy?
Well, he was in Edmonton for the first couple of years, but mainly probably, I know he goes to Nova Scotia in 1915 during the war, so he comes back to Winnipeg, so he'd be 4 or 5 in Winnipeg. So that'd be before delivering newspapers, so he would have done it in Winnipeg.
I'm not surprised about Winnipeg. I've been in Winnipeg, actually. My mentor, Rabbi Zalman Schachter, used to be the head of the Jewish Studies Department at the university in Winnipeg. Of course, now he's in Colorado. But that was a long time ago.
Right. So,
pardon me for interrupting, but I just recently, last week, had a visitor from Winnipeg. A young girl, she's middle aged, I suppose you call her, from Winnipeg, and we met at a restaurant, and we've been very good friends ever since. And we often talk about McLuhan and stuff like that. And as a matter of fact, she had never heard of McLuhan until I introduced her. Anyhow, that's my little story of Winnipeg.
Well, here it says in the Wikipedia that Hayakawa was born in Vancouver. He was educated in the public schools of Calgary, Alberta, and Winnipeg and received an undergraduate degree from the University of Manitoba.
Hey, you're a good researcher.
Yeah. Well, the Google makes it real easy. So, so he was in Winnipeg.
I know that. Yeah.
So what happened in the debate? Maybe that's more relevant. What did you see?
It was a very strange evening. I mean, they knowing both of them and being a McLuhanite rather than a Hayakawaite, I was pleased by the way McLuhan treated him. He treated him as if he was older, wiser, and more apt at public speaking, for sure. And he kind of
wait, Garrett, you're saying that Marshall treated Hayakawa with great respect?
No, with very little respect.
Here's the story, Garrett. I'm just looking at it. It says that he was an instructor at the University of Wisconsin from 36 to 39. So McLuhan, here, these two like shadow each other. McLuhan is at Madison, Wisconsin University the same year as Hayakawa. And I remember McLuhan quotes in one of his books that he fell out of a boat or something in that area, and the student newspaper mentioned it, and it was titled "Saved by." It was titled the article "Saved by a Cliche," but I can't remember what the.
No, saved by a stock response.
A stock response, right. He hung on to the boat or something, right?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah,
you
saved by a stock response.
I like that.
So here it is. That's in the 30s. You see him in the late 60s having a debate. So what else can you recall about it, Garrett, other than McLuhan had no respect for him?
But that wasn't Hayakawa with the boat. That was one of the Brits with the practical criticism.
You don't think it was Hayakawa at Wisconsin?
It was Richard. I.A.
Oh, okay. The thing is that Hayakawa was 5 years. He was born July 18th, 3 days off of McLuhan, 5 years before. So they were very same sign. Astrological sign.
Hayakawa was older than McLuhan?
Yeah, by 5 years.
Boy, that surprises me. I thought it was the other way around. I thought that Hayakawa was a kid when McLuhan delivered the newspapers. Apparently, he was 5 years older. I don't really remember the terms of the debate. All I remember is that afterwards, Marshall was kind of sorry that he had even accepted being on the same stage with him. I don't think he thought much of Korzybski either.
No, he does. He does mention Korzybski in the 40s. When he would mention somebody, it was they were a figure for a ground. And he talked about the multi-level exegesis that was coming back, the medieval multi-level, due to radio, and he said Korzybski was a symptom of looking at deeper into language than the surface print. And so he only would discuss, he was aware of Korzybski, probably read his book, and said that he was a figure for a ground. And McLuhan was looking at the ground, not the figure.
The whole question of understanding radio, I think, if Marshall's timing had been any different, the whole understanding media would have shifted precipitously. I mean, I think very often of phenomena since Marshall is gone and how he would have reacted,
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine Marshall and Google at the same time period? That might have been something really prodigious.
Yeah. Now, George, can you imagine what Marshall might say about the internet and the web?
How can I answer that?
No, but and he could. You never know what he's going to say. But if you understand Marshall's method, how would he apply? How would you apply Marshall's method? What would you say about the web, thinking in the way you understand McLuhan thought?
Well, I would say that in understanding media, covering all the senses, that the implied meaning to your question is quite simple. read the book, as Marshall would say. Read the book.
You heard him say that many times.
Read the book.
I mean, you know, Google as an equation could be seen as Google equals Global Village.
Well, how about it's the electric environment's Global Village, not the human's Global Village. It's the electric media itself extended itself.
That's right.
It's all very simple in understanding media.
Okay. So you read the book, and you find out that the computer extended the central nervous system, and the satellite extended the planet. What does Google extend? Or the web, or the Internet?
The universe? No, hardly.
Not the universe.
I would say the Google represents more in-depth studies.
In-depth.
Because if I mentioned to the girl at Winnipeg who had never heard of McLuhan, I said, look it up on the Google. And she did. And she said, I was right. You know, it's all in here. Of course it is. So it's a research tool available to anybody
if they wish.
It gives it more depth, Bob. It gives it
What's that, Carol?
Depth. It gives it more depth. It doesn't, you know, like you can, you ask what the internet would bring to that situation. I think it brings more depth. It doesn't bring another.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely harmonic. And harmonic
right.
is deep, you know, because it's a vibration and a actual visualized network that looks like a harmonizing nexus.
Yeah, Gerd, McLuhan predicted that after the satellite environment, we'd have the extension of consciousness. Not that it's all of consciousness, but I think that the Internet is an extension of consciousness in depth.
Well, the strange thing about consciousness is the notion of expanding it, you know, which, of course, was so prevalent in the psychedelic era, and whether expansion is the correct terminology. I've always wondered even doubted.
Yeah, we'd use the word extend. And what's interesting, many people pointed out that those that invented the Internet got inspired by psychedelic visions.
Some of them would. I mean, Steve Jobs and
Bill Gates
actually said that his basic ideas were the result of his tripping.
Right, and Stuart Brand would say that. And who was the guy who gave the demonstration of the mouse in 1968? Douglas Statler or something. And Stuart Brand was there at that demonstration. It's when Stuart Brand saw that use of the mouse in the computer, he thought, well, let's forget drugs, let's go with computers. To get that whatever he thought psychedelics would do. It never turned out the way he thought it would. But there's definitely, Marshall writes in the 60s that psychedelics was the most appropriate art form to understand the global theater. He had no problem with using psychedelics as a probe, since painting, music, and the old arts wouldn't do it. To take
well,
a drug
you,
like...
You understand, Marshall never came across the psychedelic world until he saw our performance in Vancouver.
Yeah, that was in January 1964. Yeah, that's true.
And you have, I think, the quote that I gave you in sound of how he said he was a Victorian. And
yes.
He didn't even like pop-up toasters. He liked the kind where you had to
flip it.
But he got it. I mean, when he saw our performance and he realized that there was a latent drug connection to psychedelics, because we talked about it at the time. It was astounding to him.
Yes, and
I don't think he'd ever met people before that who had taken psychedelic substances, although he may have.
No, he never took, as far as we know, psychedelics.
No.
But what I'm quoting is his review of Masters and whoever wrote the Varieties of Psychedelic Experience.
Absolutely, but that came some years later.
That's right, 1966, 65, 66. So he's writing about it after he's seen your thing.
Right, and, you know, I mean, I think even Ted, I don't think Ted really had psychedelic experiences, so he would have been the only other person who
might have talked to Marshall about it. The thing is, what's interesting is that McLuhan, okay, he learns about it through you, he then reads a book on it, and he understands that it is the only way to probe the 60s environment, even though he's, quote, Victorian. See, that's pretty neat.
He was so perceptive, you know. I mean, he had his fingers on the pulse of the time, I think is an appropriate metaphor.
Yes, and he always encountered people who were doing it. For example, you had just had a hit in San Francisco around the Kennedy assassination at the end of 63 with that show, and the Vancouver gallery guy wanted you to come up and meet McLuhan. And so McLuhan got to see what you were doing, a leading edge of art. He saw it right away. He always got involved right where it was happening.
That night at the museum in San Francisco, when the guy from Vancouver, whose name escapes me at the moment, although I have it in my head, I had taken acid. as part of the performance locus. So yes, it definitely.
So you was. heard the opportunity to meet McLuhan while on acid.
No, I didn't hear that. Because he didn't call us until about 10 days later. I didn't know he was in the audience.
Oh, okay.
Until he called us.
Was his name Alan? He's mentioned in the biographies.
No, not Alan. I can't get it right now, but he was the head of the gallery, and he was teaching at Vancouver.
Right. George, did you ever hear Marshall talk about psychedelics or LSD and the kids, anything? He wrote about it, but did you ever hear
him? No, I never heard him talk about that. He never mentioned it to me.
Do you think that Marshall had a whole other life going on outside of the coach house that you weren't aware of?
As the years pass by and I get further and further information, you're probably right.
Yeah.
I didn't see everything about McLuhan. I do know his basic principles of teaching was to enlarge the scope of their thought. But I have a question. Today, right now, as we speak, turn on the TV and you'll see little cartoon forms of humans. They're all distorted into shapes and people and puzzles and animals.
Yeah.
And then I look around and it suddenly struck me that young people are imitating the cartoons.
Yep.
That you see on television. So I don't know what that means, but it's rather disturbing to me.
Well, the Marshall was told, Carol LaPelle said, you write, I want to make a play out of what you write. You seem to make cartoons. So McLuhan liked the idea that he wrote cartoons. and he called cartoons the Mad MAD, Mad Vegetable to TV.
Could be.
Yeah. So you're seeing the madness of the cartoon ground becoming figure during the internet era.
That's right.
The madness of it.
Well, you know, Bob, I was kind of sad that the show in Karlsruhe isn't going to happen, because I had proposed to them the idea of making a dummy of Marshall and being on stage and asking him questions and taking little pieces of tape that exist of Marshall to answer the questions.
Yeah.
And also maybe having an actor read, you know, and tape lines out of Understanding Media to answer questions, because the various places I've been where Marshall's ideas are discussed, like in Berlin a couple of years ago, people seem to have very strange ideas about what he meant, which don't match my understanding, and which are not large enough to merit the kind of fantastic openness that he predicted and prophesied.
Right, 2 points. What was the name of the piece that you didn't get to do?
I don't know. It was just going to be a conversation with McLuhan.
You were going to do that sometime.
I wanted to do it in Karlsruhe for Peter Weibel and
the upcoming so-called exhibition.
But that seems to have gone by.
Not be happening. Well, yes. two things about what you're saying is, McLuhan in the Laws of Media predicts that linguistics, the study of linguistics by literary people, by the literate, would become medieval, complex, hyper-abstract, hyper-leveled. And that's certainly an outsider's view of how postmodern studies, you know, through Derrida, Foucault and those, they went into a complexity, it was a crisis of literate medium itself. And the professors in the 80s and 90s, and who you see in Berlin, many of them were trained in that tradition, and they are stuck in a literate way of speaking and have no awareness of how they talk like they talk, because of the reason McLuhan said is that the internet and the hypermedia of the last 30 years made spoken language in the academic context become super mysterious and become esoteric.
I recall, because I was very influenced by Sapir and Whorf.
Yeah.
And I recall that Marshall was totally knowledgeable about their work, because he and I conversed about it. And of course, that was during the Second World War, right? Because they were involved in that language school at Monterey.
That's right. So McLuhan would say that their understanding of how a tribe would be shaped by language and see the differences in tribes was due to the radio effect. Radio is not speech. Speech is the content. It's the simultaneity of the electric medium of radio that is new. And in that simultaneous condition or ground, you start to see and analyze the effect of spoken words on people. And that's where Sapir and Whorf came from.
Sure, and also the silent and the hidden dimension.
Ed Hall.
In fact, Marshall sent me out to see Hall, and I interviewed him. And I have it on videotape.
What? Is that in the 60s?
Absolutely. Late 60s.
Did you know, George, maybe George, do you remember Ed Hall at all, George?
Yes, I remember. I remember. Ed Hall. Yes, I do. Right now I'm looking for a book.
Okay.
I can't find.
No, keep looking. We got time. There's no pressure here.
At that time, Hall was living in New Mexico.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
In Taos? Was he in Taos?
Near Taos, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
now, well, Gerd, what do you think of that? Some people say Ed Hall claims that Marshall got the idea of extensions from him. Other people say that Marshall got it from Bucky Fuller. What would you say, since you knew all of them?
I would say that Marshall was above and beyond any of them, you know, and he knew all about those folks, but I mean, Ted was the one who was always bragging that it was his ideas, not Marshall's, right?
Yes, and here's the thing: Marshall wouldn't mind the idea of being attributed to others. He was pointing out why television made people notice that media were extensions. That's McClellan's message.
I got the impression from him, you know, that any tool was an extension, right?
Yes.
It didn't matter if it was a hammer or a video recorder.
Yeah, he wasn't talking about media, television, radio, newspapers. Media was anything invented by humans, including speech, was a tool.
And I've never, since that tool metaphor came across, I've always thought of how extended we become, and what the identity of the extension is. And
yeah, so
it's not just the tool; it's the fact that your hand or your mind or whatever is extended to that tool. So it's a process; it's not a product.
Right. It reverberates back on the tools that you used to have, as well as create new environments.
May I interrupt?
Yes, any time.
Oh, I have my book here.
Okay.
It's by Bruce Powell,
yeah.
P-O-W-E.
Yes.
He's a professor of English at the York University.
I was hoping he'd call in tonight. He's aware of this evening.
Is he? What does it mean to be literate in the 21st century? And he takes literacy as a form, something to be studied. And he traces the history of literacy from the beginning and its various forms. I find it very interesting.
Yeah, what's the name of the book?
Light Onwards, Light Onwards.
Yeah, that's his book about Canada. No. That's the book, the symposium.
It was a conference at York University. Yeah,
at York in 2002. Now, he had Jean Beaudrillard at that conference, William Irwin Thompson, and Susan Sontag, and a few others. But what I was going to bring up, Beaudrillard, Gerd, you have the idea that media are extensions of us and they alter us. Now, Jean Beaudrillard comes along and says, by the late 70s in the digital environment, you can't tell what's a tool and what's being extended. And you were wondering, you know, what would be the extensions now? What have we extended with the Internet? That's why I say that the Internet extends previous technologies, previous tools, not so much us.
That's a good question.
Thank you.
What bothers me is that it's habituating.
What? The Internet is a habit?
Yes, it is. It's the immersion in it and the way it comes at you. You don't come at it. It comes at you, you know. Is an experience which is as habituating as any drug.
A speech in a village or a tribe would be the same thing. People addicted to speech.
But the
early shamans would try to get people to see through speech.
There's a temporal problem because speech is kind of either person to person or person to a lot of other persons, but the internet attacks you with multiple inputs, which are so many that you can't really compass them, so you have to select. And by the time you select, you're inundated by so many others that there's a kind of a rejection
continuity.
And the continuity gets very broken up.
Okay, that's useful the way you said it, because if you look at the internet as likes, the way it involves you, you're in a tribe, you got to respond to everybody speaking, whatever it's one-to-one or one-to-many. You have one-to-many, one-to-one with the internet. But I see it's the internet inflicting the speech tyranny on other machines. And that's why it actually forces a human being to be on the sideline of the action of a speech-like tyranny in among the machines.
I hear you.
Well, in the process of learning how to read our world, how could we free the mind, lift the spirit, open perception, and forge connections? What are multiple literacies? So you have the village with a group of people in there. So,
yes, you're reading from Powell. I remember that. I have the book.
Yeah.
And that's the question that he poses, and he has these human beings, these scholars and celebrities, speak. And it comes and goes, and who remembers?
That's right.
I mean, Bruce Powell got...
Bob and George and the rest, it's Michael. I got to run, but it's been great, and I look forward to hearing the rest of the tape.
Okay, we're going to continue, Mike.
Okay, we'll see you, Bob.
Okay, thanks.
Who's that, Mike?
That was Michael Edmonds. He had to go.
Okay. Okay, Mike. Bye.
Okay, back to this issue, Garrett. I look at, we're not, even the image that we're sitting on the sidelines to this electronic maelstrom is not appropriate because you're inside it and you can edit it. You can control it up to a point. It's the image of it being a Niagara Falls bigger than you that you're referring to.
Yeah, well, I'm really referring to the phenomenon which is now called spam. You know,
yeah.
Unless, and then they say they have filters, right? Now, who do those filters really discriminate? So, you of course, personally, you wind up filtering, but when you have a barrage in the amounts that are now possible today, the only familiarity that you can respond to is real personal familiarity. In other words, there may be some very interesting stuff that is tagged by an identity that you're not familiar with. However, if one of my relatives or one of my friends' name appears there, that's what I go for, right? But
no, yeah, the paradox, you have access to the universe of information, but it tends to make you provincial or local or, quote, narrow-minded.
Exactly. Thank you. You pointed that out very well. Yes.
What do you make of that, George?
Well, it is. So far, it's very interesting. But it comes to my mind. You turn on one of the stations, CN24, whatever that means, and you get current news, the weather, the time, the temperature, what's happening, and events. And the current events are portrayed for our view. So you have people talking about things and things talking about people. And it's all there, and you get all on your five senses, or 10 senses, however
yeah.
many you have.
And so a kid, the way you would reduce that chaos is
Pardon?
Through the cartoon. The cartoon is the Esperanto, the slang of a multimedia 10-sensory environment that the electric digital world provides. That, and it assumes distortion, because the very distortion that the Internet makes in everybody's life is so intimate, they actually do understand for the first time that the medium is the message. That's why McLuhan got a resurgence. The Internet shows such rapid mutation of yourself.
That's true.
What did you say, Garrett?
There's a mirror effect. Because it's a reflection and a reverberation that comes at you. And
that's ear. Reverberation, echo, and mirror.
Right.
And you're in between that. So the Internet is an extension of tactility itself.
And the relationship between receiver and transmitter is very distorted by the medium.
That's right. But Cohen said the instant replay would begin that real distortion. People would have the meaning of the experience before the experience when they saw a replay. You walk into a room and they're watching a football game. You see the touchdown replayed before. You weren't part of seeing it when it was happening. You see it after.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the beginning of what I call the Android meme, or this distortion. The instant replay, McLuhan said, would have the most profound metaphysical confusions and effects on humans.
Yeah.
And now you got every kind of replay.
And recording. I mean, the recording has gotten to the point where there is no way.
Just a minute, Garrett. You okay, George?
Pardon?
Okay, you're okay. What were you saying, Garrett?
The recording has gotten to the point where there is no one who has the real time available to listen or see the recording that is being done, you know?
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And what are we preserving? We're preserving anything and everything. And is there anybody who has left to receive it? Sure,
well,
there are.
No, but that's
I
what
mean,
Baudrillard said. Many people, when the VCR was popular in the 80s and 90s, were recording things, 90% of it they would never watch, didn't have time.
That's
but
right.
So he said the TV watched the show for you. The VCR watched it for you. That's where the Android meme is. The Internet is media for media. The machines are doing it for themselves.
That's
the
presuming
the TV
that a machine
has replaced
the eye. Hold it, Garrett. What'd you say, George?
It replaced, our vision has been replaced by television.
Yeah.
That presumes that there's someone there. That presumes that within the dimension of the computer machines that there's somebody watching all of this. So you're talking about a meta person or a meta self or something, Bob.
No, I was quoting Baudrillard. Baudrillard said the TV VCR watched the program, not the person who set the recorder
right,
going.
Right, that presumes there's somebody there to watch something. That presumes that there's an awareness on the part of the watching television.
To me it means the machine watched it, not a person.
But there was no one there to see anything, so nothing was watched.
Yeah, other than by the TV.
But the TV,
it
would have to be self-referential in order to watch itself doing stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a presumption, and it is presumptive. You know, we go on the presumption that seeing is watching, whereas it isn't really, because we don't see what's going on. I mean, when you have as many channels as, and here am I, we were experimenting with multi-channel before it really was
a global environment
prevalent, but we were doing it on one surface, you know, but now
in one room.
Yeah, but now it's
universal.
It's stacked.
Right, it's stacked up.
And I don't remember who that was, but who said it was presumptive. That's exactly the right word for it.
A presumptive of what? Of that somebody's watching it?
No, presumptive as a philosophical entity.
Yeah. That's why I say the machines are doing it for the machines. And what kind of, you know, when you look at Bloomberg,
that implies
all the
motivation, Bob. That implies
no,
motivation.
No, it doesn't. I don't know what the
satisfaction.
No. It's nothing to do with us, Scott. I don't know what the machines are getting out of it.
It's nothing to do with anything that any. There's no. Action.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the humans. That's my point.
Well,
it doesn't have anything to do with anyone unless there's a sentient creature behind all of this who's making observations.
Yeah, and Baudrillard pointed out that people don't watch the recordings they intended to watch, and so he said the VCR watches it.
But the motivation, which I like the way Scott brought that up, both intention and motivation are ethical principles, in a sense, and the technology by this time has voided any semblance of motivation or intention.
Right. And Baudrillard is right to say, maybe it's metaphor for him, that the TV watches the stuff for us.
Well, that's just a joke.
Yeah. It's a good joke.
Yeah, it is a good joke. You're right.
And it's not recognized as a joke because the students read Baudrillard in class in the school literary context, and they think it's serious philosophical thinking.
Yeah. Well,
which is like McLuhan was aware of that dynamic. That's why he would agree that he wrote cartoons. Yet you will not see, you know, in any Who's Who, Marshall McLuhan, well-known cartoonist. You don't see that. You see he was a theorist of communications. The literate world puts him in that category, and he was not limited to that. You know, Gerd, you missed earlier. The first thing Marshall said to George every day when he walked in, he said, George, what's the joke today?
That's right.
Yeah.
He would begin his day by looking at the grievance the joke told him.
Well, I think we're getting a little bit off topic here.
Okay, well, where have we gone?
What's the topic?
What's the topic, George?
We're coming close to the end. and the end is this. Driving up to Witchwood Park, the driveway to a little patio outside the door, front door. And Marshall was there. Corinne was there. Harley Parker was there. And a few other people. And I got out of my car. I walked up. And Marshall jumped out of his seat. Corinne, George is here. As if that was some great event. And to Marshall it was. And those were the last words he'd ever spoke.
That was just before his stroke, you're saying, the summer of 79.
That was the last words he ever spoke.
Wow.
Aloud, to my knowledge.
Wow.
He slumped back into oblivion.
Oh, this is after the stroke.
Absolutely.
He said, George is here.
Yeah.
Well,
he could not speak.
And yet he said that.
And he said that.
Well, Michael Edmonds tells a story of some videotape someone made in late 78, 79. It was a videotape sent maybe to Bob Hittel down in Florida, the guy who did the bibliography. And Marshall says on the tape, I guess Michael taped it, said, "Well, it's just me and George now. That's all that's here." He started his message with that. It's just you and him.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. George, you came down with him to Fordham?
Pardon?
When he was at Fordham, you came down with him?
Indirectly. He told the story earlier, Garrett. He had gone out to, he was working with Harley Parker in the Royal Terrier Museum. Parker got fired. George went out to Saskatoon, had a job there, and he got a call late at night from Harley saying, "Hey, we're down at Fordham. Get the hell down here immediately." So he was asked to go down there from Saskatoon. And that's how he ended up there, to help. He said, "We need you." And you know, Harley was talking about the design projects and that. That's how George got there.
That was about the time that Father John
Colkin
wanted to get the church to buy a satellite.
Yeah. Do you remember John Colkin, George?
I knew him quite well. Yes, I do. Great big guy. He was bigger than tougher than Harley.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's true.
A great guy. He was a priest.
Yeah.
Yes.
But he was a fallen away priest. He gradually saw the light.
But I mean, at the time of Fordham, I think it was John Colkin who
brought him there.
Thing happen.
Yeah, that's why Colkin got in trouble after, according to Ed Wakin, because of the debt that happened.
Well, it was because, you know, of this kind of jingoist feeling that came around that it was not appropriate to have a Canadian get that grant.
Yes, that's right.
Which was ridiculous. But it's, you know.
Well, what did you think when you would go to Fordham and hang out with McLuhan? Were you nervous? Did you think you were among great minds? Did you think you were a fellow artist? What was your personal feeling as what
Who,
you were interacting
me?
With?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I was with a friend.
Right.
From the first time I met Marshall, we were friends. Because he was a
it's a companionship.
Right.
You feel quite at ease, quite at home.
Hey, Bob, Bob, are you calling McLuhan an artist?
I call him everything. Who said that? Who asked that?
It's Riff Rider.
Riff Rider. I don't know who that is. Do we know you? You have another name? Anyways.
It's my alias. Anyways, it's Riff Rider.
Riff Rider, I don't know you. But anyways,
welcome.
Yeah, welcome. That's a good question. Is McLuhan an artist? Well, he certainly explained the puniness of the art world compared to what he was doing.
I don't know. I think he had tremendous respect for art.
As a symptom. But when cultures are business became a trend in the 60s, he had a different level of response to the art world. That's why he could say psychedelics was more valuable for understanding the present than any art or sculpture or composition. That's what he said in his review.
So the system of objects, or objects in general, images, et cetera, those aren't really valid cultural metaphors anymore, at least in the McLuhan context?
Well, that's a good point, because Baudrillard would say that, and he's the one who wrote the book System of Objects.
I inadvertently used that phrase, but yeah, that's a book that he actually wrote, System.
Yeah, and Baudrillard, by the late 70s, you know, a few years after that book, said there were no objects in the digital era because of simulation. You couldn't know the origins of objects, so you didn't know what's what. You couldn't name things as objects or media anymore. And the question is, did Marshall understand that? And Don Thiel would say yes, because Marshall used Finnegan's Wake, and Finnegan's Wake shows that. And Beaudoin doesn't tell you about Finnegan's Wake stating his insight before Beaudoin.
What does it say about – so what happens as far as you know, if you look at human beings today and human beings making things, and I mean, where does that put expression or creativity today, or is that even a valid activity?
Well, if you think of dialectics, the principle of contradiction means that either side of that question works, you know, the object side and the non-objective or subjective side. So, I mean, Marshall was an expert at contradiction, and he understood dialectics from the Marxist viewpoint, by the way, which is amazing.
Yeah, Paul Grosswaller writes a whole book illustrating that. As a Marxist, I guess, Grosswaller sees how McLuhan is very similar to the Adorno School. But let me stun you with my McLuhan expertise. The very first sentence McLuhan wrote in the first essay of Explorations that came out in December 53 was, this is the sentence, "The desire, the natural desire for a person to have others think like him and to express themselves has some new implications today in the TV world." That's the very issue, Riff Router, that he wrestled with. Because he writes in the essay we talked about last week, The Southern Quality, in 45-46, he describes the effect of the atomic bomb. On the first page, he says the one thing that's going to be really threatened by this is the artistic ego. Because the corporate nature of communication that comes in after World War II, including the global intercom set up by the Pentagon, is a natural affront to the literate original mind in the literate tradition of the Gutenberg Galaxy, or the artist. That is what Marshall addressed constantly. What's the role of the artist?
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point. And I guess the question I have is that, then why do we still have the archetype or the pop star? Why do we still have Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga? How come that image hasn't retired or you know, dissipated and is still kind of being replaced?
Well, you know, celebrity is not art.
Right, but I can...
It's an aberration.
What did you say, George?
It's an aberration.
And an apparition, a phantom.
And aberration. Well,
yeah.
I think you're both right. I think when you say that celebrity is not art, I think... But I guess the question... Let me rephrase the question, because I think it's an interesting...
Well, Rip, you don't have it. I've got a good answer for you. The reason there will be celebrities for a long time in Western culture, it is that McLuhan discovered the meme level in 1953, and Crick and Watson discovered the gene level. The Western archetype of the individual embedded by literacy is continually marketed to young people because they grew up in a world in the West thinking they are individuals. So that's a hologram replayed for kids of the Gutenberg psyche. That is what's marketed to the kids.
Okay, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Right.
But how long, so if we look at what kids are doing today with social networks and with so-called different new forms of social media and so on, are we going to see that dissipate? Are we going to see, or do you think so, or not, or...
Adam,
it's
going
to proliferate, not dissipate.
No, what is going to dissipate? The individual expressive ego? You mean, Gerd?
No, I said it's not going to dissipate. It's going to proliferate.
Okay.
Go ahead.
For instance, now you look on the internet and somebody says something, or there's a news story, and then you have 30 to 40 comments on it below it, and, you know, the chain just keeps growing longer on the commentary, and the commentaries are not even necessarily connected to the original.
Where do all these ideas, fresh ideas, coming from? From the minds of 7-8 year old kids.
Yeah,
it's gossip.
But you got several things happening there, Gerd. The the first sentence in that first essay, the desire for the human to express himself and have the world think like him, that innate instinct is being expressed on the comment page, and people are talking rapidly. But also Adam Egoyan, a Generation X filmmaker, who would have grown up in the time of the after image of the artistic genius ego, he went to a movie with his son, and he was shocked. This is just a few months ago. I read it somewhere. In Toronto, he went to a movie, and he was shocked at how he saw these young teenagers in that age texting, talking, doing all kinds of stuff that Marshall attributed to tribal audiences when they watched movies. Anyways, mm-hmm. these kids, the content of this movie was a very minor part of this social interaction that went on in the theater. Now, he's used to looking at the movie as a serious artifact, almost like a novel, and he was shocked that his own son and they're interacting with each other with no real concern about the movie. That's an example of non-literary social identity, but they do have to go through the media environments of commenting because they're trained to be a literate individual with a driver's license and all that, but it's contradicted by the way they live more and more.
And yep. the older environments keep circulating around
yes.
cliched archetypes.
They're very powerful, the older psyche. McLuhan said any new media environment comes in, it's ingrained. It's like a gene, but it's a meme. It stays with us. And why does politics, why do we have a president of the United States? It's obviously a silly institution now, but it represents the ambitious individual, the literate, goal-oriented individual who arrived at some pinnacle of decision-making.
I'd like to hear, Gerd, your opinion. Do you think that the presidency is a ridiculous institution of no value propped up just so that we can satisfy our need to feel like we're individuals?
That's for you, Gerd.
No, I don't.
Well, at the beginning of this, There was a Carol, or whatever her name was.
Yeah, the New Yorker, yes.
And the question was, what's the most important thing happening in the world? My answer to that is, well, she was talking about the world conflicts and
yeah.
things like that. Well, that's a lot of hooey. The basic thing is wrong with the world. Is religion, is a misunderstanding of religious philosophy, and the truth or not.
That's literacy.
Well, isn't that a trap that Marshall fell into since he became a Catholic?
No, wait a minute. Marshall did not fall into any trap. My great story about Marshall is one time we arranged to meet and exchanged some papers in an airport. He was going in one direction and I was going in another. And I said to Marshall, wow, you know, we've only got minutes. This isn't long enough. And Marshall crossed one arm with the other and he said, you never know what you get in the crossing. So
you never know what you want.
What you get in the crossing.
The crossing, as he crossed his arm. Fantastic
yeah.
experience. I can repeat it ad infinitum. And I agree with you, George, about the problems that religion causes. But, I mean, Marshall's faith was, I think, signal to a lot of his work and to how
his
he
metaphors.
He was so good about that. And I didn't realize until much later that he hadn't grown up as a Catholic. He was a Catholic.
That's right.
Right?
We found a new clip, Gerd. I'll send it to you. He talks about he's a backdoor Catholic. He did not come into it through Catholic instruction like young people. And it's really good. He talks about how he studied the effects of the church before he entered it.
That's right.
I'll send you that, Gerd. Very good five-minute thing we just found where he talks about that the convert is the back door because they do not come in through the concepts or indoctrination. He said he never read the catechism. He knew nothing about Catholicism up to that point in 1975 on the conceptual level. All he did was pray and attend the Mass, and the Mass was the big metaphor for the action of media.
It was a critical mass.
Did you say a critical?
Yeah, it's a critical mass.
Yeah, it was a critical mass.
Am I one of the critical mass?
Yes, you are a critical mass.
I am part of the critical mass. And to whom am I speaking?
Critical mass, you go to the critical massage.
This reminds me, I need a massage tomorrow morning. It's getting late.
Are you feeling you're going to leave us, George?
Yeah. To whom am I speaking? Bob Dean.
Yeah, that's me.
And who's the other man from New York?
Gerd Stern.
Derek Stern.
No, Gerd.
G-E-R-D.
G-E-R-D. Gerd.
Oh, I see.
German.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have met you. And have a long discussion.
You know, I've seen your name here and there. And it's it's very possible that we met at Fordham.
Yes.
We might have.
Yeah.
I'm sure we have.
George, you attended pretty well every Monday night seminar. We're doing this every week. I'll bring you back in anytime you want to come in, even next week. You know, you don't have to be the featured guest and go through our interrogation, but you can join the conversation, and they're going to be good ones.
Where?
On this number every Monday.
Write this number.
Yeah, I will bring you in every week if you want to.
Monday.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much.
Okay, George, so you're going to hang up. We appreciate that you shared. As a friend,
What is your number?
I will give you the number. I will call you and bring you in like I did tonight.
Okay, give me a call next week then.
I will.
Righto.
Yep, as a friend used to say, we enjoyed having the treasure of your wisdom.
Okay.
Thanks,
my
George.
Pleasure. Okay.
Hey, Gerd, on your edge, oh, it says, Gerd Stern is a poet, media artist, and cheese maven.
Well, that's right.
That has to do with the fact that my family of several generations were in the cheese world, and I joined them for a while, although I haven't been in that world for the last, about 15 years.
Yeah, Gerd joined, as soon as Marshall died in 1980, late 80, Gerd joined the cheese world. He knew it was over.
Is that right?
Yeah, right.
I don't doubt it.
Yes. All right, you can just disconnect, no problem. I will remain hooked in.
Okay.
Thanks,
Bob. Good night, everybody.
Good night, George.
Good night, George.
Have a good rest.
Yep,
okay,
thank you.
Good night.
So, Gerd, I can go on for a while, and anybody else who wants to. We can continue.
I really need to go too. It's late here, and I've got an early morning start.
Well, we appreciate what you said. Is there any? Why don't you join in next week or any Monday? We're on for the next year. Call in again.
The same numbers.
Yes, same numbers.
I don't know what happened earlier. I just couldn't get an answer from the phone.
That happens sometimes. It does happen that you can't get in for a while. You just keep dialing and you'll get in.
I will do that.
Yeah, just keep trying.
It's very nice to be part of this.
We're bathing in the memory of someone worth remembering, so that's why it's fun.
Is the water hot or is it cool?
It's corpus callosum. We can't tell anymore. We didn't get in the water. The android meme did.
Well, I mean, is this, you remember all of the cool, hot imagery that Marshall was so fond of.
Here's something you may not know. He told Eric a year or so after that came out in Understanding Media, he says, that dialectic doesn't work. We got to find another. And he came up with so it was all he was known for the next decades, hot and cool. But he went on to cliche and archetype and figure and ground.
Well, figure and ground, of course, came from...
Gestalt. Gestalt.
From what?
Gestalt, the founder of Kohler, Wolfgang Kohler.
But what about, his his mentor in the art
Gombrich?
World. Yes. Exactly.
Well, Gombrich may have used that, but he used to always say in interviews in the 70s that he got figuring ground from the discipline of Gestalt. Gestalt psychology. But yeah, Gombrich, I had a friend, Joe Keogh, was a great McLuhan scholar. He actually organized the bibliography of the Gutenberg Galaxy. He's no longer with us. He said that when you read Gombrich's Art and Illusion, there's so much stuff that McLuhan got from there and from Siegfried Gideon. It's like Marshall never made anything original.
Well, on the other hand, Jung was big on figure and ground also.
Yeah. But see, here's the secret about figure and ground. Figure and to see a figure and think of the ground, or see the figure in the ground, is the bias of the visual person. The split vision. You know, remember They Became What They Beheld in Ted Carpenter's book? He has the image of the rabbit, the optical illusion, the trompe-l'oeil, the rabbit and the something else. They flip back and forth. He says a literate person sees them flip back and forth. A pre-literate person does not see the flip back and forth. He sees them both at the same time. So the flipping back and forth is a visual effect from literacy, and that's what most people think figure... No, that's... They think they're saying something significant, but when you say figure ground, you're expressing your visual bias. And McLuhan tried to get past figure ground, so he had two figure grounds. That's metaphor. One figure to one ground is equal or in ratio to another figure ground. So you begin with that. And another interesting point, when you read Eric McLuhan's PhD thesis, where he lists off all the characteristics of Menippean satire, one of the key aspects of Menippean satire over the last thousands of years is you regard language as a tool.
Well, if you flip too fast, it gets psychotic.
Yes, for the literate person, not for the ayahuasca users.
There's a lot of ayahuasca being used in the last few years. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, that's why I cite it. You know, you have the Aboriginal pre-literate societies that use drugs with no problem, but now you have the internet makes kids want to do it with ayahuasca. It retrieves ayahuasca for literate, semi-literate kids.
Well, my sense of it in around here and is that the ayahuasca cult is more about very sophisticated thinking people who are into consciousness.
That's true.
It's one psychedelic I've never done, but.
I've talked to my co-host James Martinez on Cashflow, is an expert on it and done many trips to Peru, and I've never done, as far as I know. But it's really an extension of proprioceptive energies. And Eric McLuhan mentions in his book The Electric Language that the internet is an extension of the proprioceptive sense. So a drug like ayahuasca, which enhances the proprioceptive sense, is retrieved when they're in an environment of Google, which is an extension of the proprioception. That's how you would use McLuhan in that context.
But it's a very different experience in Peru or in any other climate, like Michael Harner's experience with it. You know his work?
Michael Harner, no. What's that?
He's an anthropologist, I don't know if he's still alive, but he was a good friend of mine, and he took it with the Indians, and he was rather big, and they were rather small, so they gave him an enormous dose. But I mean, you know, the question of being able to take something in the environment which it belongs in and then transport it to a modern environment. Stuart Brand made that mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, he loved the peyote ritual, right?
Yeah.
And one time he set up his teepee, and instead of peyote, they took acid. We is what I should have said. You can't have a peyote ritual on acid because you know it was a
No, that is what happens in the electric age of multiple cultural access. That's why McLuhan said we had the highest sensibilities in the 60s and since, because nobody could identify with the particular culture they're in because there's so many new media cultures coming at them, and that would lead to the unique situation of somebody doing peyote on acid.
Now, this is a very strange example, this conversation.
Yes.
I mean, this conversation, which could involve, I gather, quite a lot of other people, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
We don't know who we're talking to.
But it's a whole different media experience.
Yes, that's right.
How many people are we talking to?
Well, you just have to hang up and then call back in, and when you call back in, it tells you how many callers are on the line. You don't have to do that, but that's how you find out. If anybody's listening wants to do that, we don't know. So you
don't know right now how many people are online with you?
No. I would have to hang up and then come back in.
Okay, I think...
I'm listening. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Carol's there since the beginning.
Yeah,
did you hear George's... Carol, did you hear George's critique of you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You think the world's in chaos because you've been watching TV and the chip body, and you're missing the fact that that's just an extension experience coming out of the chip landscape.
Well, it's funny. I think that when I heard that there were 9 people on.
When you came in, you would hear a number. Is Chad there? Maybe it's just the 3 of us now.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chad. A lot of people are on mute. A lot of people are on mute, Gerd, doing other things while listening.
I'm here. It's Eva.
Angela's here. Is Riff Router still here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Your voice is so familiar. I've heard you in other contexts. Where would that be?
With James.
You've called in?
No, you and I talked about anonymity. On James's
show. Oh, Chad Scoville.
That's right.
That's how I know you. Chad Scoville. Yeah, well, welcome, Chad. Chad actually infiltrated the Arthur Coker C theory and wrote an article for them. Right,
okay,
Chad?
Right. I don't know them personally, but I felt that it was inappropriate.
Yeah, I just want to add to you, Gerd, as you go. When, you know, Ed Hall brags about he came up with the idea of tools as an extension, and Bucky Fuller said his bit. But none of them knew that Marshall took that idea and satirized the idea that media were extensions of us. And the clue is in Eric's listing of the idea that language is an extension, is a tool. That idea is a traditional trope in Menippean satire. And McLuhan said he wrote Menippean satire. That's probably the most esoteric you can get in understanding
what
McLuhan.
Kind of satire?
No, the fact that the very ideas that McLuhan is known to propagate, like media's extension of our senses, was a Menippean technique, a Menippean idea, and that's why he said he wrote Menippean.
I don't know the word Menippean.
Oh, okay. Well, Menippean means the writer satirizes the reader, not the politician or the sinful one or the vice.
I got you.
I mean, Finnegan's Wake is the ultimate Menippean satire in book world.
It's positive feedback loop.
Yes, right. It's what's your poem? Let's end with your immortal poem that you always have to cite about the now, ow. Can you do that?
Take the no out of now, then take the ow out of now, then take the then out of now. And, you know, it seems to me very simple, but I have to explain it all the time. You know, which means that what I say to people who ask me what that's all about, I say, first you take out the negative, then you take out the pain, and then, because we're talking in English, you take out the then, which is both the past and the future in English. So what are you left with? You're left with the contraction of the word now, which is no, the first two letters, ow, the last two letters, and now, all three of them.
Yes. Excellent. And that poem was evoked by television. That's what McLuhan would say.
Well, it may have been evoked by television, but it's a mantra.
Ah, mantra, the retrieval of mantra sensibility by Maharishi was retrieved by the television, too.
Okay. Well, I'll hope to join you next Monday.
Yes, this is, you have been recorded, Gerd, tonight. You've been recorded, so this will be forever retrievable.
Well, I mean, you've already recorded about 15 hours of me.
What is it? It's 24 hours.
Oh, my God.
24 hours.
You multiplied me.
Yes, 24 hours.
I prefer being multiplied to subtracted any day.
Yes, well, you're being extended and expanded, Gerd.
I'm very happy that all of you are there tonight.
All right, thanks a lot, Gerd.
There again, low.
All right, low. Mahalo. Hey.
Bye.
Hey, Riff Router, now we know who you are. I knew you were Finn. We did a whole interview where we talked a few times on the phone. So did you hear the session we did last week?
I actually listened to it today before I dialed into tonight's seminar.
I thought you'd be intrigued by the idea that McLuhan said Poe was the first in the West to study the effect of machines. You find that interesting?
Yeah, it was phenomenal. Yeah, it was great to listen to you guys talk about, and then going into Frankenstein and the argument about Mary Shelley.
Yeah, it was good stuff. So what would you bring to us now? What's on your plate that you want, as McLuhan would say that, what's on your plate?
I'm interested to see what you think about the media ecologist perspective on the uprisings in Africa, and whether those would be legitimate democratic movements, or are they just a replay, or a phatic tension.
Now that's a good phrase, but I'll let Scott, Carol, Chad, you people talk for a while.
Oh, God, I've got to go, Bob. I mean, it was great to hear you guys, and I will try to call in again next week.
Yeah, you can pretty well count on us doing this every week. You know, occasionally I might miss it, but you can just know that you can join into a discussion every Monday.
Okay, thanks so much for everything.
You're welcome, Carol.
All right, take care.
All right, thanks. Bye. So, Scott or Chad,
I'll just make an opening statement about that. And that is that, to me, it depends on the level of absorption and interest that you have in what's going on down there and what's your perspective, what's your bias, what's your profit loss or concerns. Because there are people who are, you know, they're totally absorbed in the political aspect and the struggle of what's going on down there. And that's what it is all about. And then there's this meta level in which we can look at it in terms of are these retrievals occurring because of changes in the sensory bias happening at the level of meta technology, which takes it to a whole other level of discussion or abstraction. I don't have an answer to your question, but I'm just throwing out a couple of probes there and hoping to open up the space a little bit if anybody else has something to say.
I see it as a reactionary situation to the post-information situation that we're in that's been sort of rippling across the globe since 9/11, people realizing that every aspect of this world of the Android meme that people perceived as being this giant control structure, they're seeing just how small it's become. And with the situation like in Egypt, to become aware of how fragile such a small system can be on the level of like technological hardware and software, yet the meme of the internet continues. Like it's kind of, there's a friction there between, you know, the government can turn off the internet, but at the same time they can't turn off the internet because it's a meme. they can only shut it down temporarily. And I think that's driving people crazy, is they're starting to become aware of the meme, not just the technological infrastructure. It's putting them in this new psychological dilemma, or sort of psychospatial, psychosomatic dilemma.
You know, once we've all tasted and are aware of the new water, how can anyone take that away or prevent us from having it?
Yeah, that's what I mean by the way the meme persists, and people realize that, and that they can, like, even if they didn't rally for the internet to get turned back on or anything like that, it still would have got turned back on by some other group, you know?
Yeah, it was, I guess they were able to block it locally within a certain geographical area, because you can't turn the whole system off. So it's going on all around. It's orbiting all around, except these places where these little regional areas where they're trying to block it. It's like trying to block a tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
You both are laying out good statements that support the five-bodied model. You got the chip body, you got the chemical body's desires for local food and supplies and government conflicting with the chip body. And then the TV body is everybody watching it. And then you have the spiritual body or the astral body in there. So, Chad, I would say we're not here. I'm not a media ecologist. I'm a paramedia ecologist, because there's no media to put my foot on, right? So
right.
I would call it paramedia. What Chad, the post-information aspect of the Android meme, I was saying back in 2008 on James's show that the election of the mystery man indicated, you know, Obama indicated the end of the Android meme. And when Scott's saying that people Chad was saying more and more people know it's a post-information society, that's post-Android meme. This Egyptian thing is a result of people over the last few years realizing that the electronic global village or global theater is not a Leviathan thing. So that's why it is, the Android meme is gone, it's obsolete, therefore it works for all kinds of chemical body purposes like political revolution. And all they had to do was just sit there in the square and knowing that there was no power that they were resisting. And that power freaked out due to this TV body spotlight, right, just as is happening to Gaddafi now. The TV body spotlights the leaders, and they get nervous and run to the edge of the Nile or something. And the people were just sitting there tweeting. It's obviously the most appropriate sociological model for that is to use the four-body model.
The other thing, I agree, and I think those are all excellent statements. The thing that I thought of why I think Scott was talking was that specifically about the reaction to the mainstream media or the television media with regards to how they covered these. And Hillary Clinton, I mean, just to say, you know, I heard on Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! This morning, there's an Hillary Clinton went and testified before the United States Congress about how the media that the United States actually projects overseas is getting overrun by people's interest in Al Jazeera. And that Hillary Clinton says we need – she said Hillary Clinton actually spoke to a general in Afghanistan, and he said – the only thing I know about America is that all men are wrestlers and all women run around in bikinis. But I think, I guess that joke probably wasn't too good, but...
No, that's good. That's
perfect.
Good.
It's the essence of the whole Charlie Sheen phenomena.
And there's
Unless we should talk about Charlie Sheen, because that's very interesting.
Okay, two points just to me, what you just said. General... says that kind of ironically. General said that 20 years ago, and when TV, CNN was a big force aground. It's almost like he knows to say that to Hillary to bug the Americans. There's a detachment because he's actually operating on the chip body level, and that's a comment on the image in the TV landscape. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Bob, can I say something about that?
Is this Angela?
Hi, Angela.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Angela. She must have knocked herself out.
Yeah, sorry.
I was on mute. For me, Africa is basically that the Android meme image of it has totally changed, because before, the everyone used to perceive like Africa, or even like as a that whole area within the Android meme, as like just like not an accurate portrayal. So basically, because of Egypt, they now like that whole image rippling through the Android meme, Africa's Android meme image is actually changing. And not only is it changing like from like this third world level that everyone perceived it as, they're now actually making the internet a human right because of what they did. So it's like, it's massive what happened there, because it's like Egypt, because the internet got shut down there, basically people began to see the government, that they actually had like power over the internet, and that they could like switch it off at any time. And it was more, for me, Egypt was more about the world's reaction to government taking the internet down, which is basically the new society, because the old society from like the Gutenberg press model is completely, is corrupt, is in simple terms. And now what's happening is they're actually making the internet a human right. So there's like satellite being bought that's going to be the new global connection. So the government now has like no, like within a year, will have no, how would you say, control over what people do within the Android meme.
Yeah, no, that's one of McLuhan's lines was, if it's obsolete, if it works, it's obsolete. The internet is now part of our genetic makeup, you know, as a body, and you can't remove it from people. It's not where the action is in terms of the leading edge, but it is something that the whole globe could demand as a right. You say, you're not going to deprive me of oxygen. Yeah, see,
yeah,
and they would not have felt that way 10 years ago.
And it's interesting because somewhere like Africa has seen as like a third world impoverished image, that like it's either Trokra or like some charity thing feed the starving people, like,
yeah, those are the chemical body, that's the ghetto of,
yeah,
the chemical body. They don't live in that world, they have chip bodies too.
No.
So you can't even use the United,
yeah,
Nations mandate of feeding the world hardware, you know, which was Bucky Fuller's game. That's a minor thing. People are more, they could be starving, but as long as they got their iPhones or their internet,
they feel like
they're living.
That is such a false premise. The thing that drove the whole thing in Egypt was the fact that people's chemicals bodies had reached a level of dissatisfaction. They weren't getting their basic needs met. And
I've heard that too, but I'm a little bit skeptical about that.
Yeah, I side with Chad on that. That's the American projection. That's the book,
yeah,
people.
The only thing I know about what's happening over there is what CNN tells me. So
that's right. And they'll present a book literate humanist concerns about starving people. That's what the United Nations was built on.
Yeah,
that's
but
what
that was that. That's like the old image. It's like,
yeah,
like
I agree.
Really old.
Yeah,
when people aren't getting their basic needs met, everything else starts falling by the wayside, and they start becoming determined and increasingly determined and getting together, how can we get our basic needs met here when there's all this filth and wealth all around us and we can't eat? That will always trump technology.
Yeah, but
wait a minute. The thing about technology is that it amplifies, like if you're living in a junkyard and, you know, the media is amplifying that junkyard aspect of where you're living, it's going to make you really upset and you're going to become violent. And that's one of the things that happened, like let's say when television first got sent down to South America, and then they could see images of these rich upper class Americans in contrast
to where they
were living.
The bikini.
Yeah. So this contrast between these images that they're seeing globally and what they have in their own backyard makes them upset and creates revolutions.
But also, for me, it was that the image that people perceive, like Africa, is completely not what's actually happening there. Because like, only
right.
people that kind of knew the presence of Egypt were people that were on like IMUV, which is like a virtual chat room that you wear an avatar and you can talk to people. And you can see, like, there's flags from all over the world, like, more than you thought. And, like, when you're on it, it's like, whoa, there's loads of, like, Egyptian people here, you know, that kind of way. And then it was, like, So for like on a Android meme global image of say like how like all that area is represented, it was incorrect, and it was the impression got updated because of the controversy that was going on there. But what people don't realize is just like they were campaigning against their chemical body, but the moment that the control system or government system stepped in and on a global level announced that the government have the right to take away your internet if you're not using it correctly, everyone's like, the whole global village is like, whoa, that's not on, like, and now,
right.
So it's almost like the first global unite of like the control government system, which is an old model of like how to manage a society.
That chemical body government overstepped their boundaries. They weren't aware of media ecology. They weren't aware of the different types of space. And then they tried to police in an area that was outside of their jurisdiction, and they got the blowback for that.
Yeah,
that's right.
They're not welcome in that world, because the old government printing press structure society